You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening here. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
And so there we've seen very major shifts taking place within the Middle East and even in the broader Asian region, where countries are aligning with China and Russia and Iran to the detriment of their links with the United States and NATO, where Turkey is in a transitional period of asserting itself as a regional power. And all of this is upsetting historic geopolitical alignments, which were established since the end of World War II, and it's evolved right through the neocons. But we're in a very different world today.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Michelle Chosadovsky. Today's show, The Broader Global Crisis. Michelle Chosadovsky is an economist and the founder, director, and editor of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. He is the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, America's War on Terrorism, and The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. Today we concentrate on the global crisis, North Korea, Qatar, Iran, Turkey, Russia, China, Venezuela, Cuba, and a major geopolitical shift taking place in Pakistan and India. Michelle Chosadovsky, welcome.
Delighted to be on Guns and Butter.
You made a recent trip to South Korea. With all of the saber-rattling by the U.S. and North Korea, what did you learn about the Korean situation when you were there? To follow current events on Twitter and in the news, it reads like a reality TV show.
Well, maybe we should ask President Trump whether this is a reality TV show or whether he really means to press the button. But I should clarify a number of things. It is not Donald Trump that decides on the use of nuclear weapons. Why? And people are very confused in this regard. In 2001, under what is called the Nuclear Posture Review, the U.S. nuclear doctrine was overhauled, redefined, and a certain category of nuclear weapons, which were called tactical nuclear weapons or mini-nukes, were reclassified as conventional weapons. In other words, they could be used alongside other conventional weapons. And these mini-nukes, in fact, are not different from the strategic nuclear bombs of the Cold War era. They have some different characteristics. They have a lesser yield, but in fact, they go from one-third to six times the Hiroshima bomb, and I think there's some that are even more dangerous than that. But the very act of redefining these nuclear bombs as conventional weapons and giving them a label and saying, quote-unquote, they're harmless to the surrounding civilian population means that Donald Trump doesn't decide. It's a three-star general in the war theater, in the conventional war theater, who can, I'm not saying he will, but who can actually decide to use a tactical nuclear weapon. Most probably will coordinate with Strategic Command headquarters in Nebraska, but it is not for Trump to actually intervene. It's a Pentagon decision. And this was the object of a fair amount of debate in the Senate, including our Senator Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat of California. And at the time, that was actually, it was subsequent to the actual vote in 2002, 2003. But then Senator Edward Kennedy at the time also made the point and said, you are, in fact, blurring the relationship between weapons of mass destruction and conventional weapons. And he was firmly opposed to this redefinition of nuclear bombs. And then what they introduced was the notion of the, and this is a military concept, the toolbox. Okay? Now, the toolbox is a box from which the military can choose, or the three-star general can go in and choose what he wants. And so that these mini-nukes, which are bunker buster bombs or nuclear warheads, were recategorized by the U.S. Senate, and they become bona fide conventional weapons. And we don't need to go and ask Donald Trump whether we can use them or not. Mad Dog Mattis will probably get the last word on that. And that's the guy who actually bombed the hell out of Fallujah during the Iraq War. Now, what I did learn from my trip to South Korea, there's a new president. The previous president was impeached. We hope there's a freeing of political prisoners. The new president is in favor of dialogue with the North, and this was crucial to our debate in South Korea. South Korea has a defense cooperation agreement, which in time of war puts the entire South Korean armed forces under the command of a three-star general appointed by the Pentagon. And since the armistice agreement of 1953 was never repealed by a peace agreement, that means that the United States is in a state of war against North Korea since 1950. There was a truce, but there was never a peace agreement. Now, people in America don't know, talking about security and so on, that up to 30% of the population of North Korea were killed as a result of U.S. bombings. More than 90% of cities were destroyed. Pyongyang was totally destroyed. And then we have to ask ourselves, and it's very important in assessing U.S. war plans in relation to North Korea, does a country which lost 30% of its population during a U.S.-led war in the 1950s constitute a threat to the United States of America? Or does the United States of America constitute a threat to the security of North Korea? There's not a single family who has not lost a loved one during that war. And then put yourself in the shoes of the North Koreans. What would happen, let's say, if a foreign country had bombed major cities, New York, Washington, Chicago, right to the ground, as they did in North Korea, and that there were close to 100 million people killed, one-third of the U.S. population. That is what happened. And it's not a question of accepting or denying that interpretation. The U.S. military actually acknowledged that they killed. They said, General Curtis LeMay, we must have killed 20%. He said 20% of the population of that country and destroyed every single city. Okay, the exact quote is there. So that is what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a country which has been threatened for the last 67 years. We're dealing with a country which lost 30% of its population during the Korean War, which was totally destroyed. And the media is turning reality totally upside down and presenting North Korea as the aggressor because it has developed nuclear weapons as a means of deterrence. Whether that is something we support or not, I personally don't support it, but it was a choice that they made following almost persistent nuclear threats by the United States starting in 1950, the threat of nuclear war. So they've been living every single year. They run war games with scenarios of nuclear weapon attacks against North Korea. And this, of course, has created a response on the part of North Korea in developing their own nuclear arsenal.
In May 1951, after President Truman had relieved him of his command, General MacArthur testified to Congress that, quote, the war in Korea has already almost destroyed that nation of 20 million people. I have never seen such devastation. I have seen, I guess, as much blood and disaster as any living man. And it just curdled my stomach the last time I was there. After I looked at that wreckage and those thousands of women and children and everything, I vomited. If you go on indefinitely, you are perpetrating slaughter such as I have never heard of in the history of mankind. That from General MacArthur. Now, isn't it also true that they devastated South Korea?
Well, they also devastated parts of South Korea, and there was a program of targeted assassinations in South Korea. And those war crimes actually, they were not an object of discussion within South Korea. And then just about, I think it was about 10 years ago, they opened the dossier and the victims, the families of the victims started to speak out. It was something they couldn't do during the military governments that they had. But you see, the situation now in South Korea is that if we look at U.S. strategies, which is really to make other countries do the war for them, so to speak, like they're doing in Yemen, they mobilize Saudi Arabia to go and bomb Yemen. But with their joint defense agreement, they could trigger a war between the North and South. So that agreement has to be rescinded. That was the object, actually, that was the object of our discussion in South Korea. But and at the same time, now the South Korean president says we're going to have dialogue. But the question is the issue of sanity within this reality TV type of environment. There's a certain sanity within South Korea, as far as policymakers are concerned. They have said we want to talk to the North Koreans. After the impeachment of the daughter of General Park, Mrs. Park, there was the candlelight movement, and they want to enter into dialogue. Now, the United States is trying to block them from initiating a dialogue with the North. So if you ask what is the outcome of these fire and fury statements by President Trump, I would say we're at the crossroads of perhaps the most serious crisis in modern history, because a nuclear attack on North Korea, or even a conventional attack on North Korea, would escalate. And bear in mind, Trump doesn't have too much of a knowledge of geography. North Korea has borders with Russia and China and South Korea, and is in almost within swimming distance of Japan. So there you are. You've got these five countries Japan, North Korea, South Korea, China, and Russia. And it is very unlikely that the Russians and the Chinese would let things happen at their doorstep. And there's a lot of behind-the-scenes negotiations at this time. But we're dealing with people who, first of all, don't understand the impacts of nuclear weapons. And I don't blame them for that, because if they read the military manuals, they'll say that tactical nuclear weapons are harmless to civilians. And I should say that the tactical nuclear weapon, just to show how absurd it is, had been contemplated during the Clinton administration against Libya. Okay, it was the first initiative in that regard. And then we had another situation where analysts said we should use nuclear weapons against Saddam Hussein, okay? Tactical nuclear weapons against Saddam Hussein. So that the whole discussion and debate on nuclear weapons is ultimately to give them a human face, say these are peacekeeping bombs. We can go after Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein in his bunker buster, drop a bunker buster bomb with a nuclear warhead, and so on and so forth. And ultimately, we have a president who may read these briefs, but at the same time, he doesn't have the critical mindset to understand that those briefs are fabricated. Okay, so we're feeding fake news to the United States president. It's what I would call internal propaganda. It is to create a consensus in favor of nuclear war within the realm of decision makers, and it transcends. It's within the State Department, it's in the U.S. Congress, and so on and so forth. And we've seen this unfolding. They have seminars for top officials and so on. So that the lies to the public are one thing, but they are lies within the decision-making apparatus, which ultimately incite those decision-makers to conform to a consensus. And the consensus which is building up now, apart from the Russiagate thing, is that, as far as nuclear weapons are concerned, is that they are just one among many other forms of military intervention. And that we can now, and that's where the doctrine of preemptive warfare came in. It's not only preemptive warfare in conventional terms, it's preemptive warfare using first strike nuclear weapon for defensive purposes, which is a very skewed type of argument. We're going to defend ourselves by blowing up a country which allegedly threatens us. So far, North Korea is not threatening the United States. They've only said that they would target one of their ICBMs and land a bomb close to Guam, but within at least 20 or 30 miles of Guam in the ocean. That's the only thing they've said. They're not threatening the United States. They're saying, well, if you threaten us and you want to attack us, we have the ability to respond. And I think that is something which people have to take into account.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, The Broader Global Crisis. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
First of all, the United States has refused to sign a peace treaty, but they have also refused to acknowledge the reunification of North and South Korea. And the reason that they have blocked the reunification is that if that reunification were to occur, Korea, a unified Korea, would constitute a regional power which would be sovereign in relation to the United States of America. Now, there is, within South Korea, there's a strong movement towards reunification. There's also a movement against the departure of U.S. troops. There's also a movement against rescinding the Joint Defense Cooperation Agreement, which puts really all South Korean troops under U.S. command in case of war. But by definition, they're at war since 1950 because there was never a peace agreement. But I think ultimately, the United States foreign policy is to ensure that independent countries do not become competing powers or competing regional powers. And if you combine the high-tech industries of South Korea in quite a number of areas, automotive, electronics, and so on, it's a highly developed industrial high-tech economy. And with export capabilities, of course, Korean cars all over the place. And you combine that with the science and technology and military technologies of North Korea and a larger, substantially larger population, there what you will have is a regional power which will eventually contribute to upsetting the geopolitical balance within Northeast Asia, to the detriment of the United States. It may also at the same time change the relationship between Japan and the United States, and that those two countries also have a joint military cooperation agreement. So I think ultimately also what Washington wants is to prevent the reunification of the two Koreas, because this would create a competing world power with military capabilities, high-tech industry, and so on, which would challenge the hegemony of the United States in Northeast Asia.
Three Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, and Egypt, cut ties with Qatar and imposed a land, sea, and air blockade that is now entering its third month. You've recently returned from a trip to Qatar. What did you learn there of the ongoing crisis? How and why did the political shift against Qatar begin?
Well, there's a certain complexity there, but there's one important dimension, which is the fact that Qatar has a long-standing relationship with Iran in the area of natural gas. And the Persian Gulf has, between the two countries, Iran on one side, Qatar on the other, those reserves are the largest reserves of natural gas worldwide. They're sitting on a gold mine. And the fact of the matter is that while Qatar has links with a lot of oil companies, Western oil companies, those gas fields are jointly owned by Iran and Qatar in an agreement between the respective governments. And it's not simply a question of saying this part belongs to me and that part belongs to you. It's a joint ownership and joint cooperation. So that, I think, is fundamental. In turn, Qatar has established links with Russia in the gas industry. It also invested indirectly in one of Russia's energy conglomerates, Rosneft. There are lots of Russians and Chinese in the oil industry. And there are, of course, pipelines. Now, when you look at strategic pipelines for natural gas, a lot of that natural gas actually is exported by tanker, but they're now developing the gas pipelines. And since Saudi Arabia has come in and closed the border, what happened is there's been a sort of a major realignment. They closed the border. All the ground trade which was coming into the country came through Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. And so that Qatar all of a sudden is isolated, transformed de facto into an island rather than a peninsula. And who comes to the rescue? Iran, with large shipments of basic food commodities which previously came through Saudi Arabia. And also Turkey is involved. Turkey is also helping them. Now, it just so happens that with the closure of the border with Saudi Arabia, Qatar is now contemplating to export its natural gas through Iran and through Turkey. And that is occurring as opposed to the pipeline route which united Qatar with Saudi Arabia, which goes from Qatar through Saudi Arabia into Jordan and then into the Mediterranean. Okay, so now the pipeline routes have changed, the geopolitics have shifted, and at the same time, there's some very fundamental contradictions, because whereas Qatar now is aligned with enemies of the United States of America, namely Iran, but also China and Russia, the United States has its largest military base in Qatar. It's an Air Force base. And if I'm not mistaken, it's also the headquarters of Central Command. So that the U.S. is an ally of Saudi Arabia. It has a major military facility in Qatar. But the country is allied with Iran as far as its energy resources are concerned. And then in turn, more recently, Turkey has come in and wants to have its own military base in Qatar. So this is leading to a sort of a geopolitical crisis. Turkey is present in Qatar. Iran is present. The United States have a military base. Saudi Arabia has cut its borders. The pipeline routes have been redirected. And then the question is, how is this going to evolve? How is it going to evolve with a U.S. military facility in a country which has cleavages with enemies of America, essentially Iran and then Russia and China, all of which are in the gas industry, with China being a major importer? There's still, of course, Western companies are there. They have contracts in the oil and gas industry. That's nothing new. But the encroachment of Iran is absolutely fundamental. Now, there's another important shift which is taking place. It's a geopolitical shift. It's the role of Turkey, and it's the relationship between Turkey and the United States on the one hand, and Turkey and its relationship to Iran and Russia. And that has to do with northern Syria, where the United States is pushing for the creation of a Kurdistan proxy state or protectorate that's in northern Syria, which would be annexed, which would secede from Syria. This fighting is still ongoing. And the project is eventually to integrate that with the Kurdistan region of Iraq. Now, that's a U.S. project. Turkey has another project because, of course, they have been fighting the Kurdish project for generations. But the notion, the project that the United States would establish a Kurdistan region was already envisaged even back in the late 90s. Where portions of Iraq and Syria, as well as Turkey, would form the new Kurdistan region. And now, as a result of that, there's been a sort of a clash between Turkey and the United States, to the extent that Turkey has recently acquired the S-300 air defense system from Russia. Now, how does that fit in? When we know, first of all, that Turkey is a heavyweight in NATO, and when we know that the air defense system of NATO member countries is under NATO standards and it's using Western and U.S. technology and not the technology of the Russian Federation. So there you have a member of NATO, heavyweight of NATO, which has purchased its air defense system from Russia, which is on the U.S. NATO hit list, and which is also collaborating with Iran with regard to pipeline routes, from the Iranian Persian Gulf coast, but also from Qatar, Iran, Turkey, Mediterranean. So there we are. We have a very complex situation evolving. And I wouldn't exclude the possibility that at some future date there would be some kind of military, either a military intervention or, which is more likely, some kind of regime change taking place in Qatar, of which the intent would be to destabilize the country's relationship with Iran primarily, but also with Russia and China. Qatar is not a big country. It's a population of 2.2 million. Most of that population are made up of foreign workers. And the military intervention by EG, by Saudi Arabia, is not something which can be excluded. But it's a very, very unstable situation, and it marks some major realignments, on the Middle East chessboard.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, The Broader Global Crisis. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
And then in turn, if we look at broader relations between Iran, let's say Iran, Pakistan, India, very recently, that was about a month and a half ago, I believe in late June, India and Pakistan join the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and in fact, on the same day. And we know that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is essentially an alliance between Moscow and Beijing, with several former Soviet republics, observer members. But it signifies something which is pretty fundamental. Well, Pakistan is already aligned with China, and that's very significant because Pakistan was a staunch ally of the United States. But economically speaking, it is aligned with China. And India, the situation with regard to India is not clear. But what was very significant at that meeting of the SCO is that the SCO demanded that full members of the SCO would resolve their border differences in a peaceful fashion. And that was addressed to Pakistan and India. And what I think is certainly possible is that this creates a new environment. It's not the old-fashioned situation of Pakistan and India fighting for territories in Kashmir, which is essentially the legacy of the British colonial apparatus. And now there's a new era of U.S.-Pakistan relations. You know, that conflict, Pak-India conflict, has been nurtured by Washington since the Cold War era. And now you have a situation where these two countries, Pakistan and India, are members of essentially an alliance of two competing superpowers, namely China and Russia. And despite the fact that the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement has been presented as a Eurasian economic, political, and mutual security organization, it doesn't exclude the fact that it is also tacitly a military alliance, and it serves geopolitical and strategic interests. It's so to speak a counterweight to U.S. NATO. And so there we've seen very major shifts taking place within the Middle East and even in the broader Asian region, where countries are aligning with China and Russia and Iran, to the detriment of their links with the United States and NATO, where Turkey is in a transitional period of asserting itself as a regional power, okay, the Ottoman project of President Erdogan. And all of this is upsetting historic geopolitical alignments, which were established, let's say, since the end of World War II. It's referred to the Truman Doctrine, George Kennan, and it's evolved right through the neocons. But we're in a very different world today. But at the same time, we're in an extremely dangerous crossroads, largely because of the reality TV nature of U.S. foreign policy.
With regard to the blockade of Qatar, isn't a blockade considered an act of war? Turkey and Qatar completed Iron Shield war games, or joint military exercises, in Doha. This seems very serious to me.
Well, it certainly is, because it points to shifting alliances, what we might call cross-cutting coalitions. We are in that era of cross-cutting coalitions. Qatar and Turkey have established alliance now against the United States and Saudi Arabia, okay? But at the same time, well, maybe not explicitly or officially, but at the same time, both Turkey is an ally of the United States, and Qatar has the largest military base in the Middle East, right, sitting, within 100 kilometers of Doha. So it's a very contradictory relationship. I'm referring back to the map of the new Middle East, which was established by a member of the U.S. military. It was meant for academic purposes, but it shows, and that map goes back to the 1990s. It shows a situation where part of Turkey has been annexed by what the you know, what the map calls Free Kurdistan. It's a Pentagon map or military academy map. And Free Kurdistan includes part of northern Iraq and then part of Syria. And then you have another situation where there's Free Baluchistan. And Baluchistan is part of Iran and part of Pakistan and so on. So that they've certainly been redrawing the map. But at the same time, these various countries of the Middle East and beyond have been very astutely establishing bilateral agreements and alliances. The Russians have been extremely sophisticated in that regard. They establish bilateral relations with every single ally of the United States. Okay, so they have an alliance now with Turkey, which is a very significant alliance, and that was after, if we recall, early on in the war in Syria when Turkey started blowing up Russian planes. But now there's a tacit alliance between Turkey and Russia, which includes the delivery of the S-300 air defense system to Turkey. And then there's a rapprochement between Turkey and Iran. Of course, Turkey and Iran were members of the peace conferences in Astana. And we know that Turkey and Iran historically hate each other's guts. But nonetheless, now they're prepared to negotiate because their pipeline routes, and both Iran and Turkey consider themselves as regional powers, and justifiably they are regional powers. So if you look at the situation in Venezuela, Venezuela now has the largest oil reserves in the world. A large part of them are tar sands, but they're less costly than tar sands in Alberta. But that's very important. Venezuela has the largest oil reserves worldwide.
No wonder that what's happening in Venezuela is happening.
Yeah, I know the stakes are extremely high, extremely high. They're much higher than they are, let's say, in Syria. But it's also the fact that whatever happens in Venezuela is going to affect the entire continent. It's going to break down whatever trade and solidarity agreements existed between Latin American countries. It's going to affect immediately Bolivia, Ecuador, and certainly also Cuba. And it has already, in a sense, there's already been a breakdown in the relations between Cuba and Venezuela. And that's something I witnessed when I was in Havana a couple of years back. Because, to put it bluntly, the same foundations which are funding the opposition in Venezuela are also funding intellectuals in Cuba. I'm talking about the Hans Seidel Foundation, which is linked up to the Bavarian Christian Democratic Party. It's more or less the right wing of Angela Merkel. Well, they, in 2012, were behind Capriles Radonsky, who was running against Chavez. Chavez won those elections, but they were involved in funding the opposition candidate. That's the Hans Seidel Foundation. Now, it just so happens that the Hans Seidel Foundation is also active in Cuba. And the event that I went to, which was a debate on transition, political transition, Cuba, etc., normalization, was funded by the Hans Seidel Foundation. And it just so happened that there was a session of Venezuela, but there was not a single person from Venezuela who was invited, not a single intellectual. And this was a think tank and a research entity which was associated with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And then what did they do? They invited an Israeli guy who started comparing the Palestinians to Al-Qaeda. And then they had people from Austria and the European Parliament who were discussing the issues pertaining to Ukraine and support of Maidan. And nobody in the audience of these Cuban researchers actually contested these various points of view. There was an Iranian there who did actually speak out, and there was myself. But there we are in socialist Cuba, and we have a Zionist from Chatham House Royal Institute of International Affairs, pretty mediocre as a scholar who comes in and starts talking about Syria and accusing Bashar al-Assad of killing his own people and so on, when in fact the Cuban leadership had actually taken a stance on Syria, okay? Fidel Castro had taken a stance on Syria. So those are the kinds of things which are, of course, relevant, because if Cuba and Venezuela don't stick together, they'll be decimated by Washington.
Well, who sponsored this conference in Cuba?
No, the conference in Cuba was under the auspices of the Center for Research on International Politics, so to speak. It's one of the main research institutes which is attached to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And in fact, it was under the auspices, really, of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs that this conference took place. You have a research institute which is independent of the government agencies, but it nonetheless advises the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs finances it. And so they organized this conference. They got the funding from Hans Seidel. Now, Hans Seidel has a very black history, because they also supported in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union, they were supporting the transition governments in Ukraine. They were also involved in Chile. You can look at the track record. I've written this up in an article. But the fact of the matter is that while the NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, cannot set foot in Cuba, the various European counterparts, particularly from Germany, they have offices there. And they are involved in the same mechanism of co-optation. And given the fact that Cuba has a dual currency system, any payment in convertible currency is a gold mine for the people who are receiving those honoraria.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, The Broader Global Crisis. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
And what happened to me when I was invited to this conference, I got a note from the foundation, the Hans Seidel Foundation, and they said, we're contacting you to pay your expenses and to establish a contract and discuss honoraria. Okay? That's what happened. And I then contacted the organizers in Havana and said, I don't need the support of the Hans Seidel Foundation. I will be paying my own expenses. And I went to that conference and paid my own expenses, air travel. It created havoc because I somehow didn't fit into the lists that they had established and the hotel reservations which had been made by the German Foundation on their behalf. But that was a personal experience, but it also provided me with an understanding of what was going on in Cuba. I don't see a transition which will actually protect the achievements of the Cuban Revolution. I see exactly the opposite. That's despite the fact that, you know, broadly the Cuban people are committed to the achievements of the Cuban Revolution, but at the same time the mechanisms which have been set in place, dual currency system, and the funding of research by foreign foundations, it doesn't really look good. And the situation, for instance, I met up with colleagues from the universities, and this is, I would say, relatively recent. They said, well, we make our salary in U.S. dollars is less than $20 a month, okay? Now, the taxi driver will make $25 just in the ride from the airport to the hotel. And there it is. It's a monthly salary. Now, it's not to say that people are impoverished, abysmally impoverished, because they still have the safety nets of the Cuban Revolution, which are, you know, the system of ration, of essential commodities that they receive, the housing which is provided to them, and so on and so forth. But very significant social divisions are occurring between those who are paid in local currency and those who are paid in convertible currency. It's not the U.S. dollar. It's called the Cook, and it means essentially convertible currency unit. Okay, so that's the context in Cuba at the moment, I'm not very optimistic as to the outcome. On the other hand, what I sense in Venezuela is that certainly there's a regime change strategy which has certain features of what happened in Ukraine with Maidan. Rooftop people shooting at demonstrators and killing them and so on. That is certainly there. So that, in effect, the foreign policy consultants on behalf of Washington are applying the same kinds of procedures that they applied in other countries. But then there's another dimension, which is reminiscent of the last months of the Chilean Popular Unity government under Salvador Allende. I recall those events because I lived through them. I was there during the coup. And what happened is that there was a dual currency system, okay? There were dollars, and then there were escudos, and then there was hyperinflation, and there was a problem of distribution of essential commodities which had been engineered by corporations, local businesses, with the support, most probably with the support of U.S. intelligence. Of course, there was Henry Kissinger as well. But this dual currency system ultimately, plus the collapse in the standard of living, which is attributable to the scarcity of commodities or massive inflation, which is beyond the control of the monetary authorities, that is what struck me as bearing a similarity to the last months in Chile, leading up to the coup on 11th of September 1973, so that there's a process of destabilization of the monetary system on the one hand, and then there's also an issue of distribution of goods and services, an impoverishment of the population through the manipulation of markets and distribution, and then on the other hand there's, you know, the regime change, manipulated protest movements with snipers on rooftops, killing people, and then blaming the government. I mean, this notion of blaming the government, we find it in several countries. We saw it in Ukraine, where the Maidan incidents were blamed on the government, which was deposed, or Yanukovych. And we see, of course, the whole narrative of blaming Bashar al-Assad for killing his own people. So that is the kind of discourse and narrative you'll get in the media without bearing in mind that, first of all, one has to look a bit at the history. Venezuela was really a puppet regime up until Chavez, okay? Juan Vicente Gomez was the dictator from the early period of the oil boom. Of course, then with several government changes, then you had Perez Jimenez, and then subsequently the two major parties, COPE and ADECO, came in, and that was in the 60s. But today, Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world. Okay, that issue is never mentioned. It's admittedly a large part of those reserves are tar sands. The cost of developing them are much higher, but the tar sands in Venezuela are more cost-effective than those in Canada. But that makes certainly Venezuela is strategic, and the fact that the Western oil companies were penalized by the Chavez government is something that they are not going to forget very easily, and that's precisely why Chavez was in all likelihood assassinated, and that was their plan eventually, to assassinate the leader and then move into a regime change scenario characterized by financial destabilization with exchange rates, prices of essential commodities, coupled with the covert forms of intervention, paid killers on the rooftops, shooting at demonstrators, and so on and so forth. Infiltration into the armed forces as well. Infiltration into the armed forces. Because Chavez's essential support, what strengthened his government, was the fact that he had the support of the armed forces, which is not always the case in Latin American countries.
Well, how does a dual currency situation, you've mentioned this dual currency situation, both with regard to Cuba and Venezuela, how does that get started?
It starts, it's been ongoing for quite a number of years. It didn't necessarily start, in the context of the protest movement. In Venezuela, the black market has been there. And people come to accept it, you know. I recall also that in Chile, even there was a black market right from the outset of the Popular Unity government. And I think, in part, it's the inability of the authorities to implement a coherent exchange rate policy. In countries like Venezuela, where the central bank is very much related to the commercial banking system, which is still controlled by Venezuelan conglomerates, okay? There's a lot of money in Venezuela owned by the elites and so on, so that the banking system is private. Now, there was a project of actually nationalizing the banks. But the thing is, you don't really have in Venezuela people within the central bank who are capable or willing to actually resolve this issue of dual currency. The black market, the dollar versus the bolivar in the case of Venezuela, and there's a lot of corruption which surrounds that relationship. Okay, and now we have a situation where they import commodities from the world market, and then they're supposed to be sold in local currency at government prices, and they never reach the points of distribution at government prices. They're immediately sent off and sold on the black market, because the price between, let's say you can buy certain essential commodities at the government price in local currency, but you can also buy them at ridiculously high prices in local currency in the free market, so that those prices are dollarized, okay? And people who have dollars, of course, are very well-to-do, and people who don't have to deal with very exceedingly low salaries. So that essentially what has happened in Venezuela is that people have been impoverished through this process of financial manipulation, which I think is instrumented both by actors within the country as well as the integration of Venezuela's banking system into the world financial system, and the impacts are devastating. Now, one area which was very crucial in Venezuela was also the manipulation of the price of crude oil on the international commodity markets. We know that took place. These were engineered actions in the commodity markets, in the energy markets, to push the price down. After having pushed it up to more than 100 and something, it was pushed down, and in many regards, it was pushed down below the cost of production of oil in the tar sands, for instance. And Canada was also heavily affected by this. But that movement in the oil price was very much detrimental to Venezuela, and it was engineered and it was intended. It went against Venezuela. It went against all major oil producers, but it was essentially targeted against Venezuela, and it was also targeted against Iran and Russia.
Michel Chosadovsky, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Delighted to have this discussion.
Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show has been The Broader Global Crisis. Michel Chosadovsky is the founder, director, and editor of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. The Global Research website, globalresearch.ca, publishes news articles, commentary, background research, and analysis. Michel Chosadovsky is the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, America's War on Terrorism, The Globalization of War, and America's Long War Against Humanity. Visit globalresearch.ca. That's globalresearch.ca. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Wango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at Faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
You know what I'm saying? Now the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of light, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? This is a call to all you sleeping souls. And take control of your own cipher, and be on the lookout for the spirit snipers trying to steal your life. You know what I'm saying? Look within inside yourself for peace. Give thanks, live life, and release. You dig me? You got me?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. We return to the climate crisis. Alas, the culprits seem to include civilization itself, including agriculture. Holy granola, Batman! Now what do we do? We'll return to Virtual Rendering's nice audio collage after this brief word from our sponsor. I hope you'll stay tuned. Last week, we heard half of Virtual Rendering's audio collage on the crisis of our climate and ecosystem. The piece started with global warming and the people who have been warning us about it for many decades, and the corporate pundits who deny it still, and the politicians who pretend it's not a big problem. That would include Mr. Barack H. Obama, fearless champion of so-called clean coal, offshore drilling, fracking, and mining the tar sands. How's that for a change we can believe in? But I digress. Near the end last week, the focus broadened, began suggesting that the problem isn't just Western industrial civilization. The problem, it began to argue, the problem is civilization, period. We'll pick up today with more in that line of thinking. Even the backbone of civilization, that is, agriculture, is inherently destructive of the planet. We'll hear about that from Toby Hemingway, plus some wise analysis by Noam Chomsky. And we'll end with some thoughts by Guy McPherson and others on the question, well, what the heck can we possibly do? And along the way, we'll hear some post-apocalyptic science fiction. Even scarier are the haunting pleas of a Philippine delegate to the 2012 International Climate Conference in Doha. Pleas, of course, that everyone with any power quite ignored. Virtual Renderings also goes by the name Chaz K. From his own spacious underground studio somewhere west of the Ohio River, Chaz puts together several of these sound collages a year. Each one sounds a bit like the soundtrack to a documentary film, except there's no film. Well, stare with your ears, as Ken Nordine is always saying. Nordine coined the term word jazz for stuff like this, and it fits. So let's return to Chaz K's performance. The piece is called What If You Knew? And we'll pick up where we left off.
So we can't terminate industrial civilization until we shut down the nuclear power plants. It takes at least 20 years to decommission a nuclear power plant. There was a panel in New York City last weekend, which included the recent ex-head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in this country. And they concluded that it would take at least 60 years to decommission Indian Point, a nuclear power plant right outside of New York City. At least 60 years. So we can't see civilization that is making us fat, making us sick, and killing us. Because if we do, we're all dead in a short period of time. Consider, for example, Fukushima Daiichi. At Fukushima Daiichi, they're going to try to move the 1,223 spent fuel rods from the pools 5 stories above ground in a pool of water. They're going to try to move those. The unbelievably incompetent organization, TEPCO, is going to try to move those. So we can't reverse industrial civilization at this point. It took me a long time to figure that out. So we have to maintain industrial civilization, which is killing us through climate change. So getting at the root, it's all about civilization, and it's a trap. And at this point, it's a one-way street. It's a trap, and we're already caught. There's no escape. So So really, I guess the way to think about agriculture, or one way to think about it, is that it's a way of turning ecosystems into people. Because an agricultural ecosystem, well, that's it's another oxymoron. Agriculture does not support ecosystem function. You're losing soil, you're not creating anywhere near as much oxygen, you're not sequestering very much carbon dioxide, there's very little biodiversity. Farmers don't like biodiversity. I mean, in theory they do, but their actual practices. And I know I'm beating up on farmers, and you know, I will say the old cliche, some of my best friends really are farmers. And I love farming. And I love the whole idea of making your living on the land. And I grow a lot of food. So it really, you know, it hurt to begin finding these things and really seeing that agriculture, by definition, can't be made sustainable because this is what it does. This is a former rainforest that's now being used to produce ethanol and sugarcane. So it's agriculture is the conversion of ecosystems into people.
Cause something is happening and you don't know what it is. Do you?
Through the United States, 50 million people died in 4 years between the sun and the disease. And that was when the first burning booths went up. It was a sanitation thing. You stuff the bodies in, burns it down to its base chemicals, and you get the $1.86 worth out of a little slot on the side. Huge lineups of people. Trucks. Stacked high with as many bodies as they could find. Just waiting to cash them in. You could make $100 a day if you work 9 hours burning bodies. But the cash incentive, the streets got clean pretty fast. That's where the first human resources companies came into play. That's where they got their startup cash. Burning bodies of the dead, killed by the plague.
There are people who know, and there's a lot of people who accumulate wealth by accumulating information. And many of these people have known for a very long time that the carbon dioxide and the methane we release into the atmosphere doesn't show up in terms of temperatures for 3 or 4 decades. So the changes we're seeing now were locked in 3 or 4 decades ago. Changes we see in 3 or 4 decades happen as a result of what we do today. There's a huge lag between our actions today and the consequences down the road in terms of the Earth's planetary system.
Suppose you're the CEO, you know, chairman of some major corporation in the United States. Your task is to maximize short-term profit and market share, period. If you don't do that, you're out and somebody else is in. In fact, in Anglo-American law, it's a legal requirement. But quite apart from that, you just have to do it or you're just not in that position anymore. It's a crime of the position, not of the individual. That means you've got to ignore externalities. In this case, the externality is the fate of the species. It means you have to try to convince people, you have to run big propaganda campaigns to convince people that global warming is a liberal hoax and so on, which is exactly what's being done. It's quite effective. And you take a look at the Republican Congress, just about every one who came in is a climate denier. It's all a liberal hoax. We don't want to do anything. They're already cutting down funding, not only for U.S. programs, but even for the International Scientists Organization, been defunded, They don't want to do anything about it because the fate of the species is an externality. And if you're working in a market system, you don't pay attention to it. Well, in this case, there's no taxpayer to bail you out. Once you destroy the possibilities of decent human survival, kiss each other goodbye. And that's where we are right now. This is not an abstract consideration. It's happening right before our eyes, right before our eyes. Now, those are serious problems, and it doesn't make sense to ask, is that person good or bad? There's an institutional structure which is lethal, harmful in the case of, say, financial institutions, but not lethal. Lethal in this case, and that's not the only one.
Well, what can you say? What can you say? The earth is being destroyed in every way.
I think of sustainable as the midpoint between things that are degenerative, in other words, things that break things down, things that pollute, things that destroy, things that damage, which is most of, well, many of our activities, a midpoint between degenerative actions and regenerative activities. And nature, of course, is the ultimate model of regenerative, things that make things better for their having been there. And sustainable is simply the middle. Another way of thinking of that is you can continue to do it indefinitely given the resources that are available. I guess that's really the typical operating definition of sustainable. But because we are in the degenerative side of things so much, we really need to be moving from sustainable to regenerative activities. I mean, sustainable, it's not all that great. You know, it just means you do it over and over again. If someone said, how's your marriage? And you say, oh, it's sustainable. Okay? I mean, it's not all that good. It's really not. So it's what we're shooting for. You know, we're shooting for sustainable, but we really need to be thinking much, much further.
Years of high school Aquanet hairspray use have done more damage to the ozone than any global warming scam has.
I remember Aquanet.
Aquanet. Every
I remember Brill Cream, but I don't think that had anything to do with the climate.
A little dabble, do you?
That's right.
There's more. The CO2 can also go boo, 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 boo.
This day, Madam Chair, marks a very crucial moment. We are 25 days away from the end of the first commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol. But we don't really have 25 days. We have a few precious hours left. We are at a critical juncture. An important backdrop for my delegation is the profound impacts of climate change that we are already confronting. And as we sit here every single hour, even as we vacillate and procrastinate here, we are suffering. There is massive and widespread devastation back at home. Hundreds of thousands of people have been rendered homeless, and the ordeal is far from over. Madam Chair, we have never had a typhoon like Bopa, which has wreaked havoc in a part of the country that has never seen a storm like this in half a century. And heartbreaking tragedies like this is not unique to the Philippines, because the whole world, especially developing countries struggling to address poverty and achieve social and human development, confront these same realities. Finally, Madam Chair, I speak on behalf of 100 million Filipinos, a quarter of a million of whom are eking out a living here in Qatar. And I'm making an urgent appeal, not as a negotiator, not as a leader of my delegation, but as a Filipino. I appeal to the whole world. I appeal to the leaders from all over the world to open our eyes to the stark reality that we face. I appeal to ministers. The outcome of our work is not about what our political masters want. It is about what is demanded of us by 7 billion people. I appeal to all, please, no more delays, no more excuses. Please, let Doha be remembered as the place where we found the political will to turn things around. And let 2012 be remembered as the year the world found the courage to do so. to find the courage to take responsibility for the future we want. I ask of all of us here, if not us, then who? If not now, then when? If not here, then where?
Climate chaos is well underway. This is a series of assessments conducted by large organizations. As we go down the page, the predictions become increasingly catastrophic. They're based on more data and more sophisticated modeling as we go down the page. So by the time we get to the United Nations Environment Program from nearly 3 years ago, a long time since between major assessments, up to 5 C by 2050. We haven't had human beings on this planet at 3.5 degrees C above baseline. So 3.5 C, 4 C is almost certainly a death sentence for all human beings on the planet. It's not because it'll be a warmer planet. It's because the warming of the planet will remove all habitat for human beings. Ultimately, we're human animals. Like other animals, we need habitat to survive, and that habitat must include food. So without plankton in the ocean, there goes roughly half of the global food supply, because that's the base of the marine food chain. Without land plants associated with temperature extremes, cold and warm, the ability to lose land plants is growing rapidly. And there goes the other half of the food supply for human beings. If we have up to 5 C by 2050, that'll certainly do the trick. U.S. Department of Defense finally gets on board, and in their latest assessment, which just came out about 2 weeks ago, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change concludes that global warming is irreversible without massive geoengineering. This is among the most conservative scientific bodies on the planet, and they admit that we have triggered runaway greenhouse unless we do some massive geoengineering. They don't propose what kind of massive geoengineering because none have been attempted. No geoengineering strategies have been attempted at the necessary scale. So this sounds relatively dire to me coming from this organization. The relatively good news is that these assessments do not include collapse. The bad news is they don't include the positive feedbacks or self-reinforcing feedback loops. When you roll a ball on flat land, the ball, because of friction, tends to stop. When you kick the ball over a hill, the ball goes faster. As it goes down the hill, it picks up speed. That's a self-reinforcing feedback loop. We've triggered 25 of those. None are included in any of these assessments, including that latest assessment from a couple of weeks ago by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that recommends geoengineering.
If you feel you are not properly sedated, call 348-844 immediately. Failure to do so may result in prosecution for criminal drug evasion.
Any preconceived notions about money or how money works or what needs to happen or any ideas of national power or responsibility, this is a human problem. And that's the only way we're ever going to be able to approach any kind of a solution.
Some of them were dreamers. Some of them were fools. We're making plans and thinking of the future. With the energy of the innocent, they were gathering the tools they would need to make their journey back to nature. While the sand slipped through the opening and their hands reached for the golden ring, in their hearts they turned to each other's hearts for refuge. And the troubled years that came before the deluge.
Said that the world was going to end. Everyone said that everything was going to go sideways. And it did. The world did end. It's just nobody noticed. Maybe no one cared. We were too distracted by everything going on around us. We were too distracted by our own lives, by the ideas that maybe somehow some way, everything was going to be okay if we could just change the channel.
People despair when they hear what I have to say, oddly. And so I respond with Edward Abbey's quote from 40 years ago. Action is the antidote to despair. Even if, especially if, we're all doomed, let's act. If you're damned if you do and damned if you don't, then do. You've known since you were 10, maybe 12, right, that you're going to die? All of us in here have known this for quite a while. This is not some revelation. I'm not the first person to remind you, probably. But it's nice to get the reminder now and then that you're going to die. And so that maybe you should live as though the day were here. It's amazing what culture drives us to do, contrary to our humanity. So let's exhibit some humanity. Let's act. Action is the antidote to despair. Even if the action is hopeless, geez, it gives you something to do. You know, even if you live to be 100, it's nothing. Right? It's the blink of an eye. And when you're in your deathbed and you're 70 or 80 or 90 years old, you remember a few things. And not just because you're 70 or 80 or 90 years old. But because those memories are moments. The things we remember are moments. We don't remember whole days. You're not going to walk out of here and remember a third of what I said. You're going to remember moments. And some of those moments are going to stick with you for years and even decades. So let's create those moments. Those moments that we want to remember. Those moments that make us proud to be us. That make us rise above our petty selves and become what we're truly capable of becoming as human beings.
We must not believe that we are helpless victims. We must act as if we make a difference now, because the only alternative is to lay down, give up, and die. And I'm not like that, and I know you're not.
Let the music keep our spirits high. Let the buildings keep our children proud.
Now that Earth is in hospice, and all of us are in hospice, I think that points us, at least it points me, towards a way that we might want to live. Instead of pursuing glitter, pursuing gold, pursuing material possessions, accumulating stuff, what I see in hospice is people acting with compassion and giving things away. What I see in hospice is people who are not looking for another pair of shoes. Instead, they're looking for somebody they can help. What I see in hospice is people acting with a kind of empathy, compassion, kindness, and courage that we are all capable of exhibiting. That when we look through history for heroic individuals, we look at those characteristics. That's what I see in hospice. So the other little piece of advice that I give to people is to pursue what they love. Instead of pursuing what culture tells you to do, right, go to college, get the engineering degree, go to graduate school, make money, blah, blah, blah. Instead of pursuing those things that culture is screaming at you to do, why don't you instead pursue what you love?
Sector L14. Do not abandon your post. There is no danger of radiation leakage.
We have worshipped the false gods of logic, progress, productivity, practicality. If destroying the Earth for short-sighted economic profit is intelligent, reasonable, then please, God, make me a moron!
Earth was dying. If they said this on the news, if they would clarify the picture instead of seeking to confuse. If you could see the ice caps melting, if you could watch the oceans rise, if you could see the consequences right before your eyes. If you knew the kids were dying, if you could look inside the river where their food comes from, filled with cyanide. If you could hear the parents pleading, if they were looking right at you, if you could see the anguish in their hearts. What if you knew? Bombs were falling, if they showed them hit the ground, if you could see the bodies flying, if you could hear the sound, if you could see the rubble where the hospital once stood, if you saw the child's lifeless limbs, would you hold them if you could? If you knew that they were lying every time they spoke, for every laser guided pinprick there were lives lost in the smoke. If instead of just the generals they had doctors too to describe the carnage of the cluster bombs, what if you knew? They were saying when they think you cannot hear, if you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear, if you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse, if you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes. Every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few, if they told it like it is, what if you knew? Living in a huge conspiracy, would you leave your suburbs, get out of your SUV? Would you hit the streets and fight for all our lives? Would you hold your ground when the stormtroopers arrive? If you knew that the whole planet depended on what you do now, would you take a man with the speed our times allow? If the pundits told the truth for just a week or two and real life was shown on TV, what if you knew?
Do you understand what I'm trying to tell you? There are no answers. Only choices.
The human race has to learn how to leave the world alone. Alone.
On New World Notes, we heard the second part of some word jazz by Virtual Renderings, titled, What If You Knew? Good question. I've condensed the piece just a little for radio broadcast. You'll find a link to the complete composition and dozens more like it by Virtual Renderings on our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust. Thank you for listening. Illegitimae non carborundum. And, as the Quakers say, let's try to live simply so that others may simply live. Ciao.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
The focus of today's show will be government officials who can't keep the 9/11 story straight and fake news. 9/11 is more important today than ever and is still being used as the justification for the continuing fraudulent global war on terror and the frightening crackdown on our civil liberties everywhere, not just in the U.S. It's the convenient excuse given by the U.S. and its allies to invade and occupy any country in the world. And conveniently, many of these countries just happen to have coveted natural resources or land. So exposing the truth about 9/11 seems to be the only way to stop these illegal wars of occupation and the death and destruction they bring to innocent people in other countries and also to our own soldiers who bravely go into these wars believing that they are protecting their country, not realizing that they are being manipulated by their own government to further the Project for a New American Century agenda of full-spectrum dominance by the U.S. of the world, and at the same time enriching many in the arms and banking industries in the process. Sometimes the elite themselves have trouble keeping the reality and the lies straight, and they slip and say some pretty revealing things. On today's show, I'm going to share with you 8 examples of this. So let's begin with the first blooper by blooper-in-chief, former President George W. Bush, who was president when 9/11 happened. These first few examples that you're about to hear are about the World Trade Center buildings. Now remember, the official government story, as told by the government, the 9/11 Commission report, and repeated, unchallenged, by the controlled corporate and much of the supposed alternative media, is that the Twin Towers collapsed due to fires generated by the planes hitting the Twin Towers, and that World Trade Center Building 7 was brought down by fires that spread from the Twin Towers. And here he is, former President George W. Bush.
As soon as Congress acts on this bill, the men our intelligence agencies believed helped orchestrate the 9/11 attacks can face justice. The bill would also provide clear rules for our personnel involved in detaining and questioning captured terrorists. The information that the Central Intelligence Agency has obtained by questioning men like Khalaik Sheikh Mohammed has provided valuable information and has helped disrupt terrorist plots, including strikes within the United States. For example, Khalaik Sheikh Mohammed described the design of planned attacks on buildings inside the U.S. and how operatives were directed to carry them out. That is valuable information for those of us who have the responsibility to protect the American people. He told us the operatives had been instructed to ensure that the explosives went off at a point that was high enough to prevent people trapped above from escaping. That the explosives went off at a point that was high enough to prevent people trapped above from escaping.
So there you have it, Bush talking about bombs in the World Trade Centers. And of course, as many of you already know, Al-Qaeda was created by the CIA. You also know that the anthrax scare came from U.S. military and corporate sources. And that many, if not all, of the other domestic plots that Bush refers to were orchestrated by the FBI, entrapping poor and sometimes mentally challenged individuals with thousands of dollars. And don't take my word for it. It's been well documented by some mainstream news sources like Rolling Stone magazine and Fox News. And while you're at it, if you're really curious, look up Operation Gladio, and you'll learn that this isn't the first time this behavior has been used by our wonderful leaders. And now the next clip you're going to hear is a British member of Parliament making the same error that former President Bush made, talking about bombs going off in the World Trade Center towers. So here he is.
And it's worth remembering why we're here, why we're fighting, what this is all about. This is not a war of choice. It is a war of necessity. This is not a war of occupation. It's a war of obligation. On 9/11, when the Twin Towers were blown up, and so many British people died, as well as Americans.
Did you catch that? Let's hear it again.
On 9/11, when the Twin Towers were blown up, almost every single person that took part in that attack was trained here in Afghanistan by Al-Qaeda. That's why we came here. That's why we cleared away those training camps. And if we left tomorrow, those training camps could come back tomorrow.
Well, unfortunately, it looks like the only truth this British MP told was actually the blooper remark about the bombs in the Twin Towers. And now here's the current U.S. Secretary of State, John Kerry, slipping up and actually revealing a little bit of 9/11 truth about the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7, which wasn't hit by a plane on 9/11.
Also, a question I have for you. World Trade Center 7 was brought down on September 11th at 5:20 in the evening. The leaseholder of the World Trade Center complex, Larry Silverstein, gave a public interview on PBS in 2002, and he said that they pulled that building, which is a demolition term for intentionally bringing down a building. This man made over $5 billion from those buildings' destruction, and I want to know if there was ever a formal investigation into Larry Silverstein, the leaseholder of the World Trade Center complex, and his ties to this entire event.
I don't believe there's been a formal investigation. I haven't heard that. I don't know that. I do know that that wall, I remember, was in danger, and I think that they made a decision based on the danger that it had of destroying other things, that they did it in a controlled fashion.
And let's hear that again.
That wall, I remember, was in danger, and I think that they made a decision based on the danger that it had of destroying other things, that they did it in a controlled fashion.
Of course, when the 2,700-plus members of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth provide the scientific evidence proving the collapse of World Trade Center 7 by controlled demolition, they're called conspiracy theorists. John Kerry, of course, doesn't elaborate on who would have had access to World Trade Center 7 to wire it for controlled demolition. And since World Trade Center 7 housed the CIA, the Security and Exchange Commission, and other federal agencies, is it really likely that Al-Qaeda would have had access to this building for the extended period of time needed to wire it for controlled demolition? Well, let's move on to another George W. Bush slip-up. This time he's talking about the planes.
And you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to wonder exactly what President George W. Bush knew about the attack and when he knew it. According to the official White House version, it was at this moment in a Florida classroom that Bush learned the second plane had hit the World Trade Center and that the U.S. was under attack. But here's what George Bush himself said almost 3 months later when asked about September 11th.
I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower the TV was obviously on, and I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot. And I said it must have been a horrible accident. But I was whisked off there. I didn't have much time to think about it.
Now, wait a minute. George Bush was told about the second plane while he was inside the classroom. So you just heard him describe seeing the first plane crash on television that day. But that's impossible. No one saw the first plane crash on TV on September the 11th because the videotape of it didn't surface until the next day.
And the videotape he's referring to was the one caught by the supposed French film crew known as the Naudet brothers, who were in New York City filming New York City firefighters, and supposedly just by luck caught the plane hitting the first tower. I've done a show on the questionable Naudet brothers, which you can find on radioforall.net if you'd like more information about these apparently fraudulent Naudet brothers. And now let's take a look at the Pentagon. Of course, the official government conspiracy theory is that the Pentagon was hit by a plane that had been hijacked by Middle Eastern terrorists. And the plane and the ensuing fires were what caused all of the damage. First, we'll hear what a CNN reporter saw on September 11th in the morning at the Pentagon.
Outside the Pentagon, CNN's military affairs correspondent Jamie McIntyre. And Jamie, you got very close to where that plane went down.
That's right, Judy. A while ago, I walked right up to next to the building where firefighters were still trying to put out the blaze. The fire, by the way, is still burning in some parts of the Pentagon. And I took a look at the huge gaping hole that's in the side of the Pentagon. But from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon. The only site is the actual side of the building that's crashed in. And as I said, the only pieces left that you can see are small enough that you could pick up in your hand. There are no large tail sections, wing sections, a fuselage, nothing like that anywhere around.
There's a lot of disagreement within the 9/11 truth movement about what did or did not hit the Pentagon. But what has been proven is that there were also bombs going off in the Pentagon on 9/11, just like in the Twin Towers and World Trade Center 7. April Gallup, who was working at the Pentagon on 9/11, said she saw no plane parts, no luggage, no passengers, bodies, etc., and nothing to indicate that a passenger plane had hit the Pentagon. Perhaps this next slip-up by 9/11 Commissioner Tim Romer reveals what really happened.
At any point during this day, were you just, in a very base way, afraid?
There were many times, Miles, that you were afraid, that you were worried, especially when I was standing in front of the Pentagon that night, seeing one of our fortresses pried open by a missile airplane.
Okay, let's hear that again.
Fortresses pried open by a missile airplane.
Mr. Romer catches himself quickly there. You know, the actual government name for their investigation into 9/11 is called PENTBOMB, and that's spelled P-E-N-T-T for Twin Towers, bomb. So PENTBOMB. I mean, that name in itself raises a few questions. And now here's Bill Clinton on the Neil deGrasse Tyson show slipping up on the Pentagon. He doesn't seem to even get that he's made a mistake here, and that he's contradicting the official government story about what happened at the Pentagon.
By the time I had been a governor 12 years, when I got elected president, I felt that there were basically three components to any job like that. You had to have a vision for where you wanted to go, lay out a strategy, and try to execute that. That's the one thing. Second, you had to deal with the incoming fire. When George Bush and Al Gore ran for president, they had three debates. Nobody said, what are you going to do when the twin trade towers come down and the Pentagon's bombed.
And let's hear that again.
Twin trade towers come down and the Pentagon's bombed.
But now let's move on to slip-ups about what happened to Flight 93. The official government conspiracy theory is that the plane crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, while the brave passengers were attacking the alleged Middle Eastern hijackers. And now here's former Secretary of Defense in the Bush administration, Donald Rumsfeld, shedding some light on what may have really happened to Flight 93 that supposedly had crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania.
If we imagine the kind of world we would face if the people who bombed the Vestal in Mosul, or the people who did the bombing in Spain, or the people who attacked the United States in New York, shot down the plane over Pennsylvania and attacked the Pentagon.
And let's hear that again.
Or the people who attacked the United States in New York, shot down the plane over Pennsylvania and attacked the Pentagon.
And again, when someone in the 9/11 truth movement talks about Flight 93 being shot down, we're called conspiracy theorists. And now here's what an eyewitness had to say about Flight 93.
I've seen the pictures. It looks like there's nothing there except for a hole in the ground. Any large pieces of debris at all?
No, there was nothing that you could distinguish that a plane had crashed there.
Smoke, fire?
Nothing. It was absolutely quiet. It was actually very quiet.
How big would you say that hole was?
From my estimates, I would guess it was probably about 20 to 15 feet long and probably about 10 feet long or 10 feet wide.
And now here's former Vice President Dick Cheney himself, making a similar bloop about Flight 93.
you and the president had earlier discussed rules of engagement for taking down a hijacked airplane, but you were the one who gave the direct order to shoot down a plane that you were told, as it turns out incorrectly, was headed for Washington.
Right. That's correct.
What's that moment like?
Well, it was necessary. And it was a... frankly, I didn't pause to think about it very much, because once one of those aircraft became... it was hijacked, it was a weapon. We'd seen already, by that time, three of them go in to the Pentagon and the World Trade Center in New York. As a result, thousands died. And if we had been in a position to intercept one of those to keep it from striking its target, would we have done it? Absolutely. And what I did was pass on the president's approval of the basic proposition that we would, in fact, authorize our people to shoot down aircraft that had been hijacked and refused to divert. So I saw it as part of my responsibility, but I did it quickly because we had a lot of other things we were doing at the same time.
Dick Cheney is clearly talking about Flight 93 here, but he seems to have forgotten that the 9/11 Commission report said that Flight 93 crashed in Shanksville, and the reason you can't see any of it there is that it fell into a mine shaft below and was sucked into that hole. So both Rumsfeld and Cheney contradict the 9/11 Commission report and support what many in the 9/11 Truth Movement have been saying for years, which was that Flight 93 was shot down over Pennsylvania. And the evidence to support that is that there were parts from the plane found over an 8-mile radius. So these government officials that you just heard can't seem to keep the propaganda separate from what really happened on 9/11. Maybe that's why the corporately controlled, quote, mainstream media outlet, The Washington Post, recently published an article with a list of 200, quote, fake news outlets. Perhaps it was to help these aging government officials with perhaps bad memories keep the story straight by getting their news from the right sources. Some of the supposedly fake news outlets on the list of 200 are InfoWars, that's Alex Jones, Zero Hedge, True Activist, Natural News, Ending the Fed, The Corbett Report, which is one of my favorites, Washington's Blog, another good site, Before It's News, Ron Paul Institute, Hang the Bankers. Now, there's one I hadn't heard of, but now I'll check it out thanks to this Washington Post article. It goes on to add the Activist Post, the Anti-Media, Veterans Today, South Front. And by the way, southfront.org is a good website if you want to follow what's going on in Syria, so I can understand why they don't want you to see that one. And continuing on the list, Your Newswire, America's Freedom Fighters, Global Research, my really favorite website, and Paul Craig Roberts, another great website. Many of the websites that have been labeled, quote, fake news, have challenged the official story of 9/11 and the government and corporate media's demonization of Russia and Putin. It's quite an irony that a once respected corporate and, quote, mainstream media outlet such as the Washington Post would come out with an article with a list of, quote, fake alternative news sites, when it was instrumental in promoting the false news of the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, to name just one example, that helped to gather public support for the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. Journalist Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Documented in one of her books that there were over 400 CIA agents working in the corporate media. So I ask you, who are the real fake news outlets? The list of 200 alternative websites listed in the Washington Post, or the Washington Post itself? I think listening to Udo Ulfkott, German journalist and whistleblower, will help to answer that question. And here he is, Udo Ulfkott. And this is from an interview he did on Russia Today.
I've been a journalist for about 25 years, and I was educated to lie, to betray, and not to tell the truth to the public. But seeing right now, within the last months, how the German and American media tries to bring war to the people in Europe, to bring war to Russia, this is a point of no return. And I am going to stand up and say it is not right what I have done in the past, to manipulate people, to make propaganda against Russia. And it is not right what my colleagues do and have done in the past, because they are bribed, to betray the people, not only in Germany, all over Europe. The reason writing this book was that I am very fearful of a new war in Europe, and I don't like to have this situation again, because war is never coming from itself. There is always people behind it to push for war. And this is not only politicians, this is journalists too. And I just have written in the book how we have betrayed in the past our readers just to push for war, because I don't want this anymore. I'm fed up with this propaganda. We live in a banana republic and not in a democratic country where we have press freedom, where we have human rights. If you see the German media, especially my colleagues who day by day write against the Russians, who are in transatlantic organizations and who are supported by the United States to do so, well, people like me, I became an honorary citizen of the state of Oklahoma in the United States just because I wrote pro-American. I was supported by the Central Intelligence Agency, by the CIA. Why? Because I should be pro-American. I'm fed up with it. I don't want to do it anymore. So I've just written a book not to earn money. No, it will cause a lot of trouble for me, just to give the people in this country, in Germany, in Europe, and all over the world, just to give them a glimpse of a view what goes up behind the closed doors. There is many examples for that. If we go just back to history, if you go into the year 1988, if you go to your archives, you will find in March 1988 that there was in Iraq, the Kurdish people have been gassed with poisoned gas. That is known all over the world. But in July 1988, they sent me to a town called Zubaydat, that is on the Iraqi-Iranian border. It was war between the Iranians and the Iraqis, and I was sent there to photograph how the Iranians have been gassed with poisoned gas, with German poisoned gas. You call it Lost and Zarin, mustard gas, made by Germany. They have been gassed, and I was there to make photographs how these people have been killed by poisoned gas from Germany. When I came back to Germany, there was just one small photo in a newspaper, in the Frankfurter Allgemeine, and there was one small article not writing how impressive, brutally, how unhuman, how terrible it was to kill, decades after the end of the Second World War, people with German poisoned gas. So this was a situation I feel misused for having been there and just to give a documentary what has been done, but not being allowed to cry out to the world what we have done behind closed doors. Up to today, it's not well known in the public that was German public gas. There have been hundreds or thousands of people gassed in this city of Zubaydat. Now, you ask, what have I done for intelligence agencies? So, please see, most of the journalists you see in foreign countries, they claim to be journalists, and they might be journalists, European or American journalists, but many of them, like me in the past, are so-called non-official cover. That's what the Americans call that. I have been a non-official cover. Non-official cover means what? It means you too work for an intelligence agency. You help them if they want you to help them, but they will never, never, when they find out that you are not only a journalist, but a spy too, they will never say, oh, this was one of our guys. They will not know you. That means non-official cover. So I have helped them in several situations, and I feel ashamed for that too now. Like I feel ashamed that I have worked for a very recommended newspaper like the Frankfurter Allgemeine, because I was bribed by billionaires, I was bribed by the Americans not to report exactly the truth. But I just imagined in my car while I was driving to this interview, I just tried to work out in my brain what would have happened if I would have written a pro-Russian article in the Frankfurter Allgemeine. Well, I don't know what would have happened, but we were all educated to write pro-European, pro-American, but please, not pro-Russian. So I'm very sorry for that, but this is not what I understand for democracy and for press freedom. I'm very sorry for that. Germany is still a kind of a colony of the United States. You see that in many points, like the majority of the Germans don't want to have nukes in our country, but we still have American nukes. So we are still a kind of a colony of the Americans. And being a colony, it is very easy to approach young journalists through what is very important here is transatlantic organizations. All journalists from really respected and recommended big German newspapers, magazines, radio stations, TV stations, they are all members or guests of those big transatlantic organizations. And in these transatlantic organizations, you are approached to be pro-American. And there is nobody coming to you and say, well, we are the Central Intelligence Agency. Would you like to work for us? No, this is not the case how it happens. What they do, these transatlantic organizations, is they invite you for seeing the United States. They pay for that. They pay all your expenses and everything. So you're bribed. You get more and more corrupt because they make you good contacts. You won't know that those good contacts are, let's say, non-official covers or officially people working for Central Intelligence Agency or other American agencies. So you make friends. You think they are friends and you cooperate with them. But they ask you, well, could you do me this favor? Could you do me that favor? And so your brain more and more is brainwashed through these guys. And is this only the case with German journalists? No. I think it is especially the case with British journalists, because they have a much closer relationship. It is especially the case with Israelis, of course, with French journalists for a part, not that big as with German or with British journalists. It is the case for Australian journalists, for journalists from New Zealand, from Taiwan, from, well, there is many countries in the Arab world, like Jordan, for example, like Oman, the Sultanate of Oman. There is many countries where this happens, where you find people to claim they are respected journalists, but if you look behind them, you'll find they are puppets on a string of the Central Intelligence Agency. Sometimes the intelligence agencies, they come to your office and want you to write an article. I give you an example, not from strange other journalists, from me myself. I've just forgotten the year. I just remember that the German Foreign Intelligence, Bundesnachrichtendienst, it is just a sister organization of the Central Intelligence Agency. It was founded by the American Intelligence Agency. So one day, the BND, this German Foreign Intelligence Agency, came to my office at the Frankfurter Allgemeine in Frankfurt, and they wanted me to write an article about Libya and about Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. I had absolutely no secret informations regarding Colonel Muammar Gaddafi and Libya. But they gave me all these secret informations and they just wanted me to sign the article with my name. I did that, but it was an article that was published in the Frankfurt Allgemeine that originally came from the Bundesnachrichtendienst, from the German Foreign Intelligence Agency. So do you really think that this is journalism, intelligence agencies writing articles? That article was how Libya and Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, how he secretly tried to build a poison gas factory, I think in Rabta was the name, yeah. It was a story that was printed worldwide 2 days later. But I had no information on that. It was the intelligence agency that wanted me to write this article. So, but this is not the way journalism should work, that intelligence agencies, that they decide what is printed and what not. If I say no, I give you a very good example if you say no. Well, we have a rescue unit in Germany with helicopters for traffic accidents. They call themselves the Yellow Angels. There was one guy who didn't want to cooperate. He was a pilot of the helicopter service of the Yellow Angels in Germany. This guy said no to the Foreign Intelligence Service, Bundesnachrichtendienst, when they approached him and wanted him as a non-official cover to work for the German Foreign Intelligence Agency, just to pretend to be somebody from the Yellow Angels. So what happened was that he lost his job. And the court in Germany, the judge decided that they were right because such a guy could not be trusted. He was kicked off his job because he didn't cooperate with the Foreign Intelligence Service. So I knew what would happen if I would not cooperate with intelligence services. I have had 6 times my house was house searched because I was accused by the public prosecutor, the German public prosecutor. I was accused of leaking secrets of states. 6 times house searched. Well, they hoped that I wouldn't do that ever again. But I think it's worse that the truth will come out one day. The truth won't die. And I don't mind what will happen. I've had 3 heart attacks. I have no children. So if they want to bring me to court or to prison, so it's worse for the truth.
And this concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg.
Later on, Seattle Uber drivers given right to unionize. But first...
So, of course, you recognize that as Bob James, the theme from Taxi, and I never can think of a better way to introduce one of our very favorite guests, one of the real champions of the working class, Beta V. Desai, who is with the New York Taxi Workers Alliance. In fact, she is the executive director. Well, a New York State administrative law judge upheld that Uber was the employer of former drivers, all members of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, who won unemployment insurance claims in New York State. This ruling sets the stage for other lawsuits in cases involving Uber's assertion that its drivers are independent contractors. Real critical issue we're going to find out more about. This comes close after a massive wage theft lawsuit filed by the New York Taxi Workers Alliance against Uber and massive driver resistance to Uber imposed fare cuts.
Uber's race to the bottom extends to all taxi workers by flooding the streets with drivers so that making a living entails countless hours on the road. But Uber's race to the bottom also extends to its business model, which many observers contend is not sustainable in light of its continuing financial losses. And now Uber CEO Travis Kalanick was forced to resign by its investors in a scandal exposing a workplace culture of sexual harassment at Uber.
Well, Beta V. Desai, I want to start by kind of a fear. I wouldn't say cynicism on my part, but a fear, and then we can really transit into Uber. The ability of the taxi industry to survive, the question of the loss of worth of medallions, and the other problems that are plaguing our brothers primarily and some sister taxi workers. Thanks for being with us, and let's start by the prospects, really, for the future of the taxi industry.
Great. Thank you so much. So good to be back on the air with you both, Ken and Mimi. It's a race to the bottom, you know, as Ken was just saying. That's with the business model of whether it's Uber or Lyft or Get or Via, any of these companies that are looking to dispatch fares for hire to drivers, they operate, you know, their Silicon Valley business model is predicated on turning what has been a full-time profession into part-time supplementary temporary gig work. And so that means that for drivers who are owner drivers who've invested in their medallion many of them will spend 15, 20, 25 years of, you know, working six days a week, 10 to 12 hours each day in order to make up those payments. And, you know, and they invest into the medallion hoping for a retirement because there is no other retirement plan. And now they're just amassing massive debt. They're going from six shifts to seven shifts, from 10 hours to 12 hours. We've seen drivers who are in their 70s and some, you know, even in their early 80s who are coming back into driving in order to keep up with their payments. They're not able to lease those medallions out anymore. So it's heartbreaking. It's pretty devastating. It's unconscionable that all of this has happened because we've had a multinational, you know, Wall Street baby that's used investor money to supplement its low fares to attract drivers with bonuses. When the bonus periods end, the drivers are left below minimum wage. And so it's a race to the bottom because, you know, Uber starves the Uber driver so it can starve the yellow cab driver. No driver wins in a race to the bottom.
Well, the Uber model, two component points, maybe there are more, are the app itself, instead of going out and hailing a cab or calling for one, and the workers independent contractors and treating them as that rather than employees. Mm-hmm. And it seems as if you're making some breakthroughs with regard to the idea of that they are employees.
And where does the app fit in?
Well, I think it's really important that we separate the technology from the business model, right? The technology itself can be agnostic. You know, it's all about who uses it and toward what purpose. And the problem, the fundamental problem here is the economic philosophy, which says that the Wall Street money can be maximized at the expense of the workers, at the expense of consumer rights, at the expense with, you know, people with disabilities who seek equal access to service in this private sector. So the business model, as far as labor is concerned, Uber exerts more control over drivers than we've seen in this industry in 30 plus years. Yet they want to claim that the drivers are not their employees, but instead they're independent contractors. And, you know, we've made that deal with the devil in our economy and within the framework of our labor law in this country that says that when a corporation exerts control and really determines the economic destiny of the workers, then in return, it has to recognize the workers as employees and grant them minimum wage, overtime, Social Security contribution, the right to collective bargaining and democratic union, you know, the right to unemployment, you know, ACA, the Affordable Care Act, the right to, you know, employer-sponsored health care. So all of these basic rights, when workers are defined or classified as independent contractors, all these basic rights are stolen from them. And then in return, though, the workers are supposed to have some level of economic independence. Well, this is a business model that does not grant that independence. And, you know, Mimi, you know that in the taxi industry, 30, 40 years ago, when the drivers were under a commission system and were being dispatched and the companies called the shots in the everyday economic terms, you know, deciding the rate of fare, all those things, the workers, the drivers were defined, were classified as employees, mm-hmm. and they had basic mm-hmm. protections under the law. 30 years later, we have these Wall Street finance companies that want to go back to the same levels of control, but meanwhile, they want to keep the model of independent contractorship, and it doesn't work that way. And we're so pleased that not only did the State Department of Labor rule on the side of the workers, but also an administrative law judge at the Department of Labor, after a six-part hearing and a 1,000-page transcript, a very lengthy process, upheld the agency's determination and also found that indeed the three Uber members were in fact employees entitled to unemployment insurance, and other similarly situated Uber drivers would be entitled to the same rights.
Well, this is so important because the move, the shift within our society to precarity, to making sure that workers are, whether they're labeled as independent contractors, whether they're constantly in temp or adjunct positions, do not have those assured rights. It's an essential and critical issue for the working class. So I want you to just continue to talk about how important this victory that you just won is, and again, the significance of people not being labeled as independent contractors for those broad issues that you have always concerned yourself about, which is the benefit of the working class.
Well, you know, we say all the time, if you want to know why employee status matters to workers, ask an independent contractor. Now, ask the yellow cab driver who's, you know, where the structure of the industry was changed 30 years ago, went from employees to independent contractors, don't have unemployment to fall back on, don't have, you know, minimum wage and overtime laws to fall back on, you know, paid family leave, all the basic rights that generations of workers have fought for, have died for, and, you know, have struggled to sustain. There's one other point, though, I want to make here, which is, you know, with companies like Uber and Lyft, the other thing we don't have are industry regulations. You know, for 21 years, the Taxi Workers Alliance has organized. We know that yellow cab drivers have been found to be independent contractors because of the structure of the industry. But we have fought so hard to establish a floor through industry regulations, a cap on the leases that the companies can charge, you know, a fair rate on the metered fare, which is what yields drivers' incomes. And see, companies like Uber, not only are they looking to evade labor law, but they're also looking to evade industry regulation. And so there is no floor for the workers. And when that, you know, when it keeps bottoming out, it means they can keep lowering the fare on the backs of the drivers. And because the drivers are on contracts with this predatory leasing on the vehicles, they have less options to be able to leave and get another job. You know, and this has been a profession. This is a dignified profession. For tens of thousands of workers, 94% are immigrant. We are a largely Muslim and Sikh and, you know, immigrant workforce. And, you know, this is a job that serves a million people every single day. It's one of the biggest sectors in this city. We want to see labor laws upheld. We want to see industry regulations upheld. And, you know, 30 years ago, you know, the economy, the capitalist class went after taxi drivers who are left vulnerable. And 30 years later, we see, you know, one-third of the American workforce in precarious work. We are again on the front lines of an economic shift. But I assure you, we are not going to lose this fight. We're going to give it everything that we have because it does have tremendous implications for the working class as a whole. It has implications for an entire generation of workers that these companies are looking to replace with automation. And so we understand that we have a historic fight in front of us, that, you know, we've been fighting the good fight with the grassroots unionism, not doing what some others in the labor movement are doing, you know, where they've entered into the machinists have entered into a private agreement with Uber, you know, taking money from Uber and agreeing not to challenge Uber's labor violations in court or, you know, even at the National Labor Relations Board. So we're up against some pretty powerful forces, but, you know, we're ready for it and we're winning. We're beginning to win and the tide is beginning to shift.
We only have about a minute and a half left, but I want to ask you whether there is something that the Taxi and Limousine Commission could do to, like, pick out something off the top of your head that's the most important thing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first of all, regulating the minimum fare so the companies can't keep dropping out the bottom, regulating the cap on the number of vehicles so the streets don't get saturated in the race to the bottom. You know, upholding our federal lawsuits, which are calling for an end to the massive wage theft in this sector, where the TLC can also pass regulation to end that wage theft and also act as an enforcement arm against it.
And you did that perfectly. So we're just going to punctuate that. So we have the CEO, Travis Kalanick, who was forced to resign. What do we say finally about Uber and that juxtaposed as to saving the taxi industry?
We have a unity platform. What is fundamentally at stake here is our profession. It's not about any one sector. In order for the yellow taxi cab driver to survive in New York City, they need to lock arms with the Uber driver because they're all on the same front lines fighting the same fight for economic justice in this industry.
You are my working class heroine. You always have been. And
thank you, Mimi.
Is there just finally any place that we can go to continue to keep abreast on this issue and or immediately to support our brothers and sisters who are part of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance?
Yes, we're on the web, www.nytwa.org. I also just want to quickly just say that, you know, we're in solidarity with the thousands of people out there today that are disappointed with the Supreme Court decision on the Muslim travel ban. We are the same union that went out on strike on January 28th at Kennedy Airport in solidarity. And, you know, we're going to continue that fight as well, because we deserve a more, you know, more conscious, a more fair, a more just society, and that includes our refugee brothers and sisters and our Muslim brothers and sisters across this globe.
Thank you so much, and thank you for adding that. And we have been speaking to Bayrevi Desai, who is the executive director of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, and we have to keep in close touch, and we have to have that intersectionality in what we do. We do workplace organizing and support our brothers and sisters in the working class and understand the implication for their civil liberties and civil rights at this juncture and treat people holistically. Thanks so much for being with us.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Jessica Devereaux in Baltimore. On Monday, the Seattle City Council was the first U.S. city to vote unanimously to allow Uber and Lyft drivers to form unions. The App-Based Drivers Association, or ABDA, worked with the local Teamsters Union to fight for the legislation, which will allow drivers to negotiate with Uber and Lyft for higher wages. Uber Technologies has butt heads with their drivers in the past for slashing fares at their own discretion and for discouraging union organizing. Joining us to discuss all of this is Leonard Smith. He is the Director of Organizing and Strategic Campaigns for Teamsters Local 117 in Seattle, Washington, and he helped get this bill passed. Thank you so much for joining us, Leonard.
Happy to be here.
So, Leonard, I'd like to start off by asking you how you were able to get this bill passed and get drivers, specifically independent contractors, really organized. A lot of them are part-time. So how did you manage to garner support from them?
Well, they came to us. There is a feeling they have a very strong experience with the transportation network companies, or TNCs. And let me just clarify that the bill that was passed also allows taxi drivers to collectively bargain as well. It's not just Uber and Lyft, it's also taxis. And the app-based drivers came together because Uber changes the terms and conditions of their relationship at will, cutting fares, raising costs, deactivation. And they felt powerless and wanted to have a voice. And while they are called independent contractors, their relationship with Uber and Lyft is anything but that. They're pretty tightly controlled by those companies and how they conduct their business.
Can you be more specific? How are they controlled?
Well, Uber and Lyft pretty much tell them how much they're going to be allowed to charge. They tell them their conditions of employment. They incentivize them to be in certain locations. They deactivate them, which is firing them for no reason, and there's no recourse. And so if you're an independent contractor, you know, Uber doesn't allow them to take tips. And so it seems to me if you're an independent contractor and running your own business, you should be free to work where you want and take tips if you want them. And if the technology is going to deactivate you, you should at least be able to talk to somebody to find out why you've been deactivated. Normally, if a driver gets deactivated and they try and hunt down the reason why, they get canned responses coming from Uber. And in fact, I just read an article the other day that led me to believe that the people that send out those canned responses are also subcontracted out from Uber. But I'm not sure about that part.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about how Uber's really kind of captured a lot of enthusiasm in the mass media, everyday people. I mean, I'll be perfectly honest, I have Uber on my phone as well. It's really part of the sharing economy. A lot of people see this as a great way to add more competition into the marketplace. And they say it gives people an opportunity to make some money on the side, especially if you're low income, but you need some work. You know, unemployment is rather high in this company. What do you say to those people that see this bill as potentially being detrimental to Uber because essentially some of the costs, higher wages, for example, would eventually get trickled down and customers would have to be paying the difference?
Well, this bill and these associations are not anti-Uber in any sense of the word. Uber has a great platform, great technology. What this bill does is it gives drivers the flexibility to be able to go ahead and get control over their working lives and have a say in their hours and how much they get paid. And, you know, about costs being passed on, Uber used to cost a lot more money until they started to keep slashing and slashing and slashing. And even when they, here in Seattle, when they were charging a dollar or more per mile, and they've cut that since then, but even when they were charging that higher rate, they were still equally popular. And the drivers tell stories about how their customers are happy with the service, they like the service, and they're happy to pay more. They wouldn't have a problem paying more. So the drivers themselves see the need because drivers, frankly, can't operate. And Seattle has the second highest mileage rate in the country. It's my understanding. And the drivers really have difficulty time making ends meet. The way Uber works, the way Uber and Lyft work, and to call it sharing is a little bit difficult. The way they work is Uber provides a technology and the driver takes all the risk in terms of buying the car, paying maintenance, gas, tires, everything else. And we have some drivers who, do this as a full-time. There's a chunk of drivers that do it as a full-time job. And they, after expenses last year, one of our drivers found after 12 and 14-hour days, he was making about $3 an hour.
Wow.
So the promise of making a lot of money through Uber just is not coming true for drivers. Uber is aggressively hiring more drivers, getting more drivers on the street, which is good for consumers, but more cars on the street means more congestion and it means less work for drivers. When drivers ask Uber about this, Uber's response is to say, well, the more cars that are on the road, the more money you're going to make, which is counterintuitive to the people doing the work. They tell us they don't stand still only 12 or 14 hours in their workday. They can only take so many trips. How does more competition on the road make them more money? Mm. So, you know, they just feel that while, you know, nobody's presuming that we're fighting Uber or trying to get rid of Uber or anything else like that. It's just really the workers that make Uber function that provide the transportation because this technology doesn't exist unless there's cars on the road. All they want to do is come together some of these conditions that they don't have right now.
All right, let's talk a little bit more about what they don't have right now, what they're going to be fighting for, and how will this union actually be structured if they do decide to unionize?
Well, right now they have an association, and so they have an association that's affiliated with us, and we work together to achieve their goals, and their association has an elected leadership council, and the leadership council sets the policy. And then we help provide the resources and expertise to fulfill the policy goals of the association. What this legislation would do, it would give the right to the union to organize through Teamsters And then the drivers, if they chose to organize, and we had a majority and they decided this is what they wanted to do, then they could actually sit down and negotiate a collective bargaining agreement or a contract with Uber or Lyft or the taxi companies that would set their wages, their working conditions, maybe add benefits, have a process in place where they could do something about the activation, which is a huge issue for them. Right now, all these things sort of happen at will to the drivers with no say. The activation without a voice, changing the rates without a voice, other requirements for your cars, changing the requirements of the cars without drivers having a voice. And if they had a contract in place, they would be able to at least say, all right, wait a minute, before we do that, let's consider this from our point of view. How are, you know, let's get our voice in it. And you'd have a binding agreement that would hold both parties to task.
Leonard, how close are you guys to achieving potentially having a union?
Well, right now we have the association, and, you know, it's not a union in the traditional sense, but it functions as a union in that the drivers have come together collectively to get power over their working lives. So that's a definition of a union. As far as the other part, the legislation actually allowing the collective bargaining to take place, it's hard to say because we've got about another 4 or 5 days before the legislation becomes law. There's some rulemaking and some infrastructure the city has to set up to administer the law and enforce it. And there are a lot of rumors floating around out there that Uber and Lyft or perhaps some others may be planning lawsuits to stop or delay the implementation of the law.
Okay. All right. Well, Leonard, please keep us up to speed about what's going on with this story. We'd love to have you back on to give us an update. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
I think I'm doing the military a great favor.
These are people who are courageously putting their lives at risk for our country, and the reward is a pink slip.
This postal plebiscite is a referendum on freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and safe schools ideology being taught to our children.
Have a read of some of the things which are said about us and our families, and then come back here and tell us this is a unifying moment.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Presidential saber-rattling temporarily trumps U.S. trans military ban, Kuwait deports gay men in massage parlor rubout, and Australian activists go postal over mail-in marriage plebiscite. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Michael Lebeau.
And I'm Michelle Yater.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 12, 2017. The White House passed along to the Pentagon this week a guidance policy for open transgender service phase-out, making good on President Trump's July 26th tweets to end service by openly trans troops in the U.S. Armed Forces. Details of that guidance policy have yet to be revealed. Trump bragged to reporters late this week that his move to ban military service by transgender people was doing the Pentagon a big favor.
Sir, why did you decide to announce the transgender ban reversal a couple of weeks ago? And are you betraying a community that you pledged to support?
No, look, I have great respect for the community. And I think I'm doing a lot of people a favor by coming out and just saying it. As you know, it's been a very complicated issue for the military. It's been a very confusing issue for the military, and I think I'm doing the military a great favor.
However, according to reporter Karen Oakham in the LGBTQ LA Blade newspaper, this week's fiery exchange of threats between North Korea's Kim Jong-un and President Trump have temporarily put all military personnel issues on hold, including the trans ban. Defense Secretary James Mattis reportedly sent a directive to major U.S. commands saying that the threat by North Korea is his overriding priority and that other issues were to be temporarily sidelined.
Lawsuits filed this week by active duty transgender service members are preemptively challenging any effort to kick them out. One lawsuit charges that the president's directive to categorically exclude transgender people from military service is unconstitutional, because it violates equal protection and due process clauses of the Fifth Amendment. The plaintiffs are in the Air Force, the Coast Guard, and the Army, and their service includes tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. During an interview on MSNBC, John Davidson of the LGBTQ advocacy group Lambda Legal contradicted the president's claims that service by trans personnel has been a confusing issue for the military.
These are individuals who have been serving honorably without creating any disruption under a policy that was carefully crafted by the military's top leadership and that has been going fine. So there is absolutely no reason except for bigotry to not allow these people to continue to serve. These are people who are courageously putting their lives at risk for our country, and the reward is that they're going to get a pink slip.
That was Lambda Legal's John Davidson.
A report this week, co-authored by Northern California's Palm Center, a think tank that studies military service by LGBTQ people, and professors at Monterey's Naval Postgraduate School, also challenges Trump's claim that banning trans personnel will save the Pentagon a lot of money. The report projects the cost of discharging and replacing the estimated 12,800 active duty transgender service members at close to $960 million. That's more than 100 times the estimated $8.4 million cost of providing medically necessary health care to them.
Elsewhere, the leader of a Kuwait Morals Committee announced that 76 gay men have been deported so far this year, and 22 massage parlors that were allegedly fronts for sex work have been shut down. According to a report this week in Gulf News, committee members, who include representatives from the Ministry of Social Affairs and Labor, the Ministry of Commerce, and the Ministry of the Interior, seized sex toys at the raids, along with women's underwear and makeup allegedly used by the men. Gay sex and cross-dressing are both illegal in Kuwait and other Gulf Cooperation Council countries, Bahrain, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. Morals Committee Chair Mohammed Al-Dufairi told reporters that, "We have a zero-tolerance policy towards any morally objectionable activities, and we will not be lenient with anyone who breaks the rules or puts the health of Kuwaiti citizens and residents at risk." Ibrahim Bansir, a cleric at the Ministry of Islamic Affairs, supported the actions, warning that massage parlors may draw customers to the vice of homosexuality, which is strongly condemned and forbidden.
But a sports nutrition store in Russia has paid a rare price for discriminating against a gay job applicant. Edward Myra applied for a sales assistant position at LLC Hardcore earlier this year. When he asked why he didn't get the job, the store sent him a letter explaining that his feminine manner and being too well-groomed suggested a non-traditional sexual orientation that would be off-putting to many of their clientele. "Our customers are tough guys," store spokesman Andrei Chistyakov told the independent Russian newspaper Novaya Gazeta. "I wasn't only concerned about the image of the store," he said. "I was concerned about this man's health." He also cited Russia's law banning the promotion of homosexuality as another reason for rejecting the application. Myra couldn't understand the excuses the store gave for denying him a job. He said the only thing that might have made him look gay was his pierced ear. Russian social media has been on fire over the rare queer court victory. One posting said that because the shop management had exposed its bias in writing, the court had no choice but to uphold Myra's claim. A lot of posts celebrated the significant amount the court awarded to Myra in damages, 30,000 rubles or about 50,000 U.S. dollars. But another sympathized with the shop, writing that it's not their fault that the majority of Russians are not tolerant.
In other news, Canada's Defense Minister Harjit Sajjan unexpectedly danced on the Pride of Bollywood float at Vancouver's LGBTQ Pride Parade on August 6th. Sajjan has marched in other Pride parades, usually with a federal Liberal Party contingent. His security detail seemed a bit startled when he was lured by the blaring Bollywood music to break ranks with that contingent and hop onto the float and dance with other Pride celebrants for a few minutes. Alex Sanga is the founder of the South Asian queer support group Share Vancouver, which sponsors the float. He was last year's Vancouver Pride Parade Grand Marshal. This sent a very public message from a senior Canadian government minister who happens to be South Asian and Sikh that LGBTQ South Asians deserve to be treated with dignity, respect, and equality, he said. Indo-Canadian LGBTQ people often stay closeted rather than defy conservative family expectations. Sajjan is helping to break down barriers in our community, Sangha said. We thank him for that. He made our pride.
And finally, Northern Ireland's ruling Democratic Unionist Party took heat at this year's LGBTQ Pride March in Belfast on August 5th for its long-standing refusal to allow legislation to open civil marriage to same-gender couples. Northern Ireland is the UK's last major territorial marriage equality holdout, so it's not surprising that some members of the DUP were unhappy with the attendance at a Belfast Pride breakfast by recently elected Indo-Irish openly gay Republic of Ireland Prime Minister Leo Varadkar. 2 years ago, voters there became the first in the world to open civil marriage to same-gender couples by a popular vote. Varadkar's first official visit to Northern Ireland as the Republic of Ireland's PM came a day after the British government, for the first time, ordered an LGBTQ rainbow flag to be flown above its main office in Belfast to coincide with the city's Pride Festival. Varadkar was unable to march in the Pride Parade because he had a prior commitment. He told reporters at the Pride breakfast that he didn't intend to upset anyone by his presence. "I am not here to unsettle anyone," he said, "but I am here to show my support and support of my government for equality before the law for all citizens, no matter where they reside." When he was asked specifically about the prospects for marriage equality in Northern Ireland, Varadkar was optimistic.
I think it's only a matter of time. It is, of course, a decision for the Northern Ireland Assembly, but I'm confident that, like other Western European countries, they will make that decision in due course.
From your lips to the DUP's ears, Mr. Prime Minister.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 12th, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Michelle Yeader.
Just how conservative and how homophobic is Australian society? If the government's proposed postal marriage equality plebiscite goes forward, it may answer those questions more effectively than it will ultimately resolve the matter at hand. Australians consistently say yes to equality in opinion polls, but their right-leaning two-party ruling coalition is torn on the issue and nearly ruptured a week ago. So, with marriage equality dominating the headlines down under, we turn to This Way Out correspondent Barry McKay in Sydney.
Well, last week has certainly been a hectic week in Australia for the LGBTIQ community. Marriage equality protesters gathered at Sydney's Town Hall on Sunday the 6th of August, calling for a free conscience vote in Parliament on same-sex marriage in Australia.
What do we want?
Marriage equality!
When do we want it?
Now!
On Monday last week, the governing Liberal Party held a party room meeting in Canberra to ascertain what the party's position on same-sex marriage would be. At the end of the previous week, five rebel Liberal MPs had drafted a private members' bill seeking to introduce same-sex marriage into the Parliament as a conscience vote. The more conservative side of Australia's Liberal Party has always been staunchly opposed to the idea. There were fears that the issue would tear the conservative side of Australian politics apart, as the party only holds a very thin majority in the House of Representatives. The so-called rebel MPs backed down in the name of keeping the party unified. The issue had also threatened Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull's tenure. As a progressive conservative, he had always expressed his support for marriage equality in Australia. Members of the Australian Marriage Equality Advocacy Group expressed their disappointment in the outcome at a press conference in Parliament House in Canberra that evening. Alex Greenwich.
The government has yet again decided to delay, drag on and disappoint people from coast to coast.
Later that evening, Special Minister of State Matthias Cormann, who would be responsible for the plebiscite, was interviewed by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's journalist Emma Alberici on the ABC's Late Line program.
A friend of my daughter's, a 15-year-old boy, came out as gay last week to his parents and was kicked out of home. Now, whilst you and your colleagues are bickering in your party room, aren't you concerned about the message you send to young, vulnerable gay and lesbian Australians that they don't deserve the same treatment as other Australians and that when they are older and they fall in love, they won't be treated as equals with heterosexuals?
Emma, this is an issue in which there is a diversity of sincerely held, strong views on both sides of the argument. And that is, of course, precisely why the government in the lead-up to the last election made a promise to the Australian people that they would have a say on whether or not the definition of marriage in the Marriage Act should be changed, whether the law should be changed to allow same-sex couples to marry. That is the commitment that we took to the last election, and that is the commitment that the Liberal Party party room today reaffirmed.
The government consistently stuck with the same mantra all week. The following day, Tuesday, the plebiscite policy was ratified by the National Party, who form a coalition with the Liberal Party as government. As had happened in November 2016, it was expected a plebiscite would not pass the Senate and that a postal plebiscite, the government's fallback position, would become the government's official policy. Sections of the Australian media passionately spoke out in favour of marriage equality.
A non-binding, non-compulsory postal vote is complete BS.
Karl Stefanovic is a host on Channel 9's popular nationally broadcast Today show.
In my opinion, there have been far too many column inches far too much airtime, far too much taxpayer time and money wasted on an issue I believe should be decided in the parliament. Why do we elect officials if not to make decisions that reflect our beliefs? So pull your fingers out in Canberra and get on with it. Let's just look at this simply, confidently and compassionately. Why are we stopping people from loving each other? In a world where we should be celebrating love over hate, this decision is a no-brainer. This is more about the fear and naivety of non-gay people than anything to do with the problem with gay marriage.
The unofficial No campaign then began in earnest, with this statement by former controversial Liberal MP Bronwyn Bishop.
The Australian people should be trusted.
She's speaking here on Sky News.
They're saying that the institution of marriage, 1,000 years old, is being tampered with, and if it can be changed from having it a man and a woman to any two people, why not three as it is in Colombia? You've got Professor Peter Singer, who believes that children, if they're disabled, should be put to death at birth.
I'm with you.
And also if there is sex between humans and animals, that's fine.
None of that will be able to happen unless somebody votes for it to happen first.
So
the idea that two blokes getting married somehow equals disabled kids being put to death.
The point I'm making is that people are suspicious of the so-called progressive movement. And at the end of the day, the Australian people will get it right.
The compulsory voter attendance plebiscite bill was reintroduced to Parliament on Wednesday and was quickly rejected in the Senate by Labor and the minor parties, who hold the majority. The Labor Party favour a parliamentary vote on the issue. Former Prime Minister and staunch Conservative Tony Abbott also fired his first volley for the no vote at a hastily organised press conference on Wednesday morning.
If you don't like same-sex marriage, vote no. If you're worried about freedom of speech and freedom of religion, vote no. And if you don't like political correctness, vote no, because this is the best way to stop it in its tracks.
That same day, Tony Abbott's sister Christine Forster made her views known to Channel 10's show The Project.
As a gay woman who's in a relationship, who wants to get married, and Tony is well aware of our plans to get married, it's not a really nice thing to hear somebody belittling our plans to get married, particularly when he's your brother and you love him. It's pretty unpleasant, I have to say, but that's his view. I respect his right to hold his view.
Do you get a sense of there being anything that might be able to turn him on his thoughts about this?
Well, look, he's been put on the spot by his own kids as well. His kids are definitely in favour of marriage equality, and that hasn't persuaded him.
Senator Penny Wong, in a same-sex partnership with two children, gave an emotional speech to the Senate, pointing out the harm a plebiscite would have on LGBTIQ families. Her comments were partly directed at Liberal Senator Matthias Cormann, who had earlier said in the Senate that this could be a unifying moment for the country.
But I tell you, have a read of some of the things which are said about us and our families, and then come back here and tell us this is a unifying moment. The Australian Christian Lobby described our children as the stolen generation. We love our children, and I object, as do every person who cares about children, and as do all those couples in this country, same-sex couples who have kids, to being told our children are a stolen generation. You talk about unifying moments. It's not a unifying moment. It's exposing our children to that kind of hatred.
As the compulsory voter attendance plebiscite had been shot down in the Senate, a non-compulsory, non-binding postal plebiscite or postal survey became the government's official position. The cost to the Australian taxpayer would be $122 million. Prime Minister Turnbull made his position on same-sex marriage clear in the Parliament that day.
I can tell you, in this debate, I will be encouraging Australians to vote yes. And I urge every participant in the debate to act with responsibility and with respect for those on the other side.
It was announced that the postal survey would be carried out by the Australian Bureau of Statistics and not the Australian Electoral Commission, who managed the electoral roll. Much discussion followed in the Australian media as to the value of holding such an expensive exercise when the result would be non-binding on the government. There were accusations made that a postal survey would be biased towards certain sections of the Australian electorate, most notably older voters. as well as fears about postal ballot paper theft. Dr. Liz Allen, a demographer from the Australian National University in Canberra, spoke on the ABC's AM program that day.
The postal ballot, as described so far, is akin to a tear-out return slip that one would find in a magazine. It doesn't capture all of Australia's views or all of the eligible voters' views, and there are many exclusions, for example, people overseas, that may not be able to participate. There are also issues with potential tampering. Return to sender. Address unknown. No
such number. The other creative LGBTIQ community came up with an idea of how to send a message to Malcolm Turnbull. James Breckney is on the board of Sydney gay and lesbian Mardi Gras.
A couple of weeks ago, some friends of ours and me sort of decided we're going to build the Prime Minister a spine to take down to Parliament House, because he needs one. Because everyone's been sort of... It's been a thing on Twitter and stuff in Australia that our Prime Minister's a bit weak on this issue and he's not allowing a free vote to Parliament. So DIY Rainbow and Community Action Against Homophobia are taking this spine down. Funnily enough, on the anniversary of John Howard, a previous Prime Minister, when he changed the marriage laws in 2004 to be exclusively between a man and a woman.
One of Australia's most prominent gay figures, former High Court Judge Justice Michael Kirby, said that a plebiscite was an extraordinary and unnecessary measure on the part of the government.
I feel as a citizen that I am not being respected.
He spoke on the ABC's Breakfast program.
It wasn't done in the case of the advancement of the equal rights of the Aboriginal people. It wasn't done in respect of women's advancement of legal rights. I mean, it's just the complete political improvisation and it's completely unacceptable.
Also that morning, popular TV host David Kosh took Australia's Treasurer and former Immigration Minister Scott Morrison to task on Channel 7's Sunrise program.
Scott Morrison, you can understand why so many Australians are so angry that we're just wasting money on this because you politicians don't have the guts to make the decision yourself.
David, we promised at the last election that we would give all Australians a say on this.
Don't give me that. You break election promises all the time.
Meanwhile, Leader of the Opposition, Labor leader Bill Shorten, gave a rousing speech in Parliament that day.
This $122 million survey denigrates the Parliament. It risks putting Australia in a hell of a place, further behind the rest of the world. But there is one thing this survey will not do. It will not change Labor's support for marriage equality. Yeah. If Prime Minister Turnbull stops blocking marriage equality laws coming to this Parliament, the men and women of the Federal Parliamentary Labor Party will vote for equality in overwhelming numbers. And if it is not resolved by the next election, a new Labor government will legislate to make marriage equality a reality within the first 100 days. I give you this promise. We stand with you. When you don't feel like you have a voice, we will speak up for you. When you feel attacked, we will defend you. When we hear prejudice and discrimination, we will not cross the road and pretend it is not happening. We will call it out. I will be campaigning for a yes vote, and I encourage people to join the movement for marriage equality.
Head of the Australian Christian Lobby and the No campaign, Lyle Shelton, weighed in on the debate on the ABC's current affairs show, 7:30 that evening.
We're very united in working together to persuade our fellow Australians that we should retain the definition of marriage. This postal plebiscite is a referendum on freedom of speech, freedom of religion and safe schools ideology being taught to our children.
On Thursday evening, I spoke to patrons at the Stonewall Hotel in Sydney's Gay Golden Mile, Oxford Street, to ask them what they thought of the postal plebiscite.
I think the plebiscite's a complete waste of time. I don't think straight people should have a say on whether we get married or not.
I think it's silly. I think it's a waste of money, and you already know the right answer.
I think it's a terrible idea. I think it's the Liberal Party trying to enforce their internal policy against the sort of democratic process.
As many people have said, that the purpose of the Parliament is to reflect the opinions of the people, and they just seem to be abrogating their responsibilities.
On Friday morning, Independent MP Andrew Wilkie, along with LGBTIQ rights campaigner Rodney Croom, and Australian PFLAG past president, Shelley Argent, lodged an objection to the postal survey in the Australian High Court on the grounds that it was not constitutional.
The High Court has agreed that they will hear this matter with a full bench on the 5th of September.
Andrew Wilkie spoke to the press in Melbourne.
Just to reach this stage is a win for all of those people in the community who have all sorts of concerns about this non-binding voluntary postal vote.
If the High Court challenge fails, the ballot papers are to be sent out from the 12th of September. The date for the return of the ballot papers is the 7th of November, with the result announced on the 15th. And if everything goes to the government's plan, they would hope to have a result by then. Remember, the result of the postal survey is officially non-binding on the Australian government. Some in the government are saying that if the postal survey returns a yes vote, Australia should have marriage equality by Christmas. If the government were really keen to have it sooner rather than later, Australia could have marriage equality next week through a free vote in Parliament. I'm Barry Mackay in Sydney for This Way Out, and thanks also to Michael Barnett and Gregory Storer for their help with putting the information in this report together.
I've been to cities that never close down. New York to Rio, an old London town. But no matter how far or how wide I roam, I still call Australia homophobic. I'm always travelling, but wherever I stay, people love Aussies and they generally say they think we're kind, fun and funny, tall, tanned and toned, and a little bit racist, and a little bit homophobic. It's bad enough these poly assholes pass discriminatory laws, now we're forced to dance the plebiscite jig. But on the upside, this plebiscite might enlighten us. At least we'll know exactly how many Aussies are bigoted. Yay, stats! Woo! Someday we'll all be together once more, once they do their bloody jobs and just change the f***ing law. Then Carrie can marry Sally and Ben can tone in the marriage bed in their Aussie home. So you can shove your cherry-picked Bible passage up your pocket bottom. Your attempt to keep Australia in the past will be a failure, because most of Australia ain't homophobic.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from Michael Lebeau and Michelle Yater, produced by Steve Pride, and Barry McKay, with production assistance by Michael Barnett and Gregory Storer. Tim Minchin sang I Still Call Australia Homophobic, The Carpenters and Elvis Presley performed some of the other music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google Plus. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on CKDU Halifax, Nova Scotia, KCRL Salt Lake City, Utah, WCRS Columbus, Ohio, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. In this country, we classify non-white people according to their color. We lump blacks together, and we do the same with Latinos and with other groups. And we say, to make universities and other institutions more diverse, we need more of this color or more of that color, and we add up the numbers. But what if some blacks are very different than other blacks, and some Asian Americans are very different than other Asian Americans, and so on? Are we matching the reward conferred with the wrong suffered? If we don't distinguish, for example, children of rich immigrants to the U.S. from inner-city youth of the same color whose ancestors suffered under Jim Crow. David Hollinger believes that something's gone awry in the way we classify people, or more accurately, in the way that ethno-racial categories developed decades ago are still used in a nation transformed by immigration, race mixing, and other developments. David Hollinger is an historian and Preston Hotchkiss Professor Emeritus at UC Berkeley. He's the author of numerous books and articles on multiculturalism, solidarity, and cosmopolitanism, and he contributed an article about cosmopolitanism and the problem of solidarity to the new volume Cosmopolitanisms, edited by Bruce Robbins and Paulo Lemos Horta. When David Hollinger joined me recently in studio, I asked him about W.E.B. Du Bois's famous statement that the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line.
When Du Bois wrote that in 1903, he was speaking at the height of the Jim Crow era, when there were lynchings not only all over the South, but in much of the Midwest as well. I mean, this is a period where the tightening of the racist, racially defined regime of the United States was going on all around him. So when he says that the problem of the 20th century is the color line, he means that This is an obstacle. The color line is an obstacle to justice, to equality, to a humane life, to democracy, that demands to be attended to, and that it's so important that it could be called the problem of the 20th century. Now, he was right, but one of the things that happens during the 20th century is that enough people understood how right he was that they diminished the problem. Now, this is a matter of degree. We all know that there's plenty of racism, especially anti-black racism, in the United States today, in 2017. But we have, after all, had a black president. We have the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. There are many obvious changes that have occurred. And one of the striking changes is that the very concept of the color line, the very notion of race, has been interrogated much more critically in the last half century than it was during Du Bois's day. So now all our scholars and our pundits are eager to tell us how constructed these categories are. Now, the more constructed they become, which is to say the less primordial, the less these categories, these racial categories, these color categories are built into the human species, the less that, the more they become contingent products of human action. Now, if they're products of human action, then these categories become, you know, subject to change. And we are able to talk about the color line similar to other kinds of obstacles rather than something that's unique. It may be unique in its intensity. It may be unique in the scope that it has. It may be unique in its consequences, but it is not unique in its fundamental character. So that's a big change that's occurred, and I think it's partly due to the strength of the African-American liberation movement, of the civil rights movement, people like Du Bois, especially black people, but also their white allies.
And because of these changes that have occurred, you write that the problem of the 21st century is that of solidarity. How do you define solidarity?
Solidarity is a state of willed affiliation. I mean, if you talk about you have solidarity with someone, it means that you're making common cause with them, that you feel a special obligation to them, that you feel you can count on them to help you, that they're definitely part of a we, of some kind of willed community. Now, when I say that we're now in a position to describe the problem of solidarity as the problem of the 21st century, what I mean to get at there is that it's no longer taken for granted just what your we is. It's no longer so much taken for granted what your primary affiliation is. That we've had so many world historical changes, including migrations, regime change, large measure of ethno-racial mixing, so that a series of identities, a series of feelings of solidarity with some group or other, those adhesives, we might say, have diminished in force during the last 50 years, especially globalization, migration, ethno-racial mixture, cross-group marriage and reproduction. So now a lot of people are not quite so sure just who their we is. Who should they make common cause with? And it goes even right down to contemporary politics today, where we have all these quarrels about identity politics and is it really important just to stand firm with the people that are the most like you? Or is it important to reach out and try to form common alliances with people who are different than yourself? Even within American politics, to say nothing about globally. Do we have a global solidarity to deal with something like global warming and other world problems? Well, politicians disagree about that. We've seen that Donald Trump is pulling back from the notion of a global solidarity in regard to global warming and climate control. So I'd say that the situation that we face now as we go well into the 21st century is that more and more people are not sure that the inherited affiliations that they've had, they're not sure that the ascribed identities that they've been told that they have are the most important things. So people are asking the question, What do I mean by we? On just whom can I count for the most support? On just who do I owe the most support? I mean, what groups matter most to me, and where can I do the most to achieve, say, the goals of justice, equality, and democracy? Does this mean just sticking with your own kind? Well, if so, what does that mean? What is your own kind? Does it mean branching out to other groups and forming alliances with other groups? Well, if so, of what sort? And at what cost? So solidarity becomes a problem when I talk about the problem of solidarity. Solidarity becomes a problem when you don't take what it is for granted. And I'm saying that world historical changes of the last couple of generations have made solidarity, rather than something that's taken for granted, a problem.
And when you say that older traditional identities are being disrupted and destabilized, you're talking, I just want to be specific here, about categories like African American or Asian American or Latino, that kind of thing.
Yes, that's primarily it, but it also applies to religious identities and local identities and national identities. We've had all this twaddle the last 20 or 30 years about post-nationalism. Well, I think the nation state is still pretty important and has a more constituent base than some of the post-national theorists think. But there are folks that say that the nation state is a thing of the past and that globalization has created a series of new formations, multinational corporations, alliances both on the left and the right, commercial connections that will render the old nation state redundant. Now, if that's the case, then it's national categories as well as ethnic, racial, and religious categories that are up for grabs, at least to some extent. So I see this as a species-wide challenge.
Okay, so we have this problem of solidarity. And it would be nice, wouldn't it, if there was kind of a one-size-fits-all approach to solving, to addressing this problem. Do you think such a approach, a solution exists?
I wish it was, but it really doesn't exist. And how people respond to the problem of solidarity and how they try to deal with it depends so much on historical, local conditions, constitutional regimes. What kind of political tools do you have? What sort of political culture are you surrounded by that you can count on? What is the demographic mixture of a particular locale? So as a result, how you deal with the problem of solidarity in, say, India, France, the United States, Canada, to use just democratic countries, it varies a little bit. So India is a case where they're massively committed to parceling out a lot of authority on the basis of ancestral groups. Well, there's a long tradition of that in India, and you have many people of more universalist inclinations that are critical of that and are trying to press against that. Then you have people like the Hindu nationalists that are actually trying to affirm those old identities. So that's an example of where the challenges there are different than, say, for some of the European countries that are not immigrant-based, something like, say, Norway or Sweden or Denmark, where they do have these quarrels about just how to deal with the new immigrants that have come in and whether or not they're really part of the national we. But in the United States, where we are an immigrant-based society and have a migration-based sense of ourselves, there's a whole different political, ideological tradition, and there's a different constitutional tradition with a whole set of protections about minority rights and the whole federalist system. So even though it's possible to theorize it about it in general, how it's to be dealt with in a specific case varies enormously. But if one is going to talk about it in the round, the whole thing, talking about this in a species-wide way, you might say that what's at issue is a tension between two very worthy human aspirations. And the one is an aspiration toward intimacy and belonging. People need situations, surroundings, communities in which they feel a capacity for intimacy with other people and belonging. Then on the other hand, they need a way to deal with global questions, something like global warming or matters of human rights. Now, if you're dealing with those questions, intimacy and belonging are not so much in play. And so the trick is to come up with strategies, practices, regimes, political programs that respect what we might say, what we might even call the tribe, that respect the tribe, but at the same time respect the species.
David Hollinger joins me in studio. He's an historian and Preston Hotchkiss Professor Emeritus at UC Berkeley. And he contributed an article about cosmopolitanism and the problem of solidarity to the new volume Cosmopolitanisms. He has a new book coming out soon. It's called Protestants Abroad, How Missionaries Tried to Change the World but Changed America. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. There exists established what you call entrenched apparatuses for dealing with diversity in the U.S. So are we talking here about legal and other efforts to address discrimination and to rectify historical marginalization?
We are. We are talking about that. And when I say that they're entrenched, and I would even say many of them anachronistic, I have in mind an assumption which is behind many of these measures, many of these goodwill measures to diminish inequality and advance justice. What I have in mind is an assumption that all ethno-racial groups, all descent communities are enduring and clearly bounded and analogically structured, each possessed of its own myth of diaspora and its own dynamics for solidarity. Now, that assumption was very widespread in the late 1980s and down through much of the 1990s when affirmative action programs were solidified, when the ideal of multiculturalism advanced. It's interesting that when the affirmative action programs were first put in the very late 60s and early 1970s, if you go back over the hearings and the records of the congressional hearings, and if you read the op-eds and if you read the manifestos of the various advocates, it's all about black people. It's not about Hispanics. It's not about Indians. It's not about Asian Americans. But then what happens is that once it's in place for African Americans, a lot of people are sort of scratching their head and say, well, wait a minute, African Americans are not the only people that are disadvantaged. So federal agencies and courts begin putting all these other categories in there. And the assumption is that all these non-white descent communities, communities of descent, people of common ancestry, people who bear the physical marks of descent, black, brown, yellow, and so forth, that they're all somehow sort of alike. So the multiculturalist movement and the affirmative action plans are set up this way. Well, you know, it works up to a point. It does deal with genuine injustices. It does call attention in educational programs that are multicultural. It does call attention to the plurality and the diversity of American life and to many of the hierarchies and injustices that are involved in that. But it also ignores a lot of differences within these groups. And an example of how what I'm calling this anachronistic stuff continues is that as late as 1998, when President Clinton convened his national initiative on race, they came out with a list of 58 recommendations for change, not a single one of which dealt with the unique situation of black people in the United States. And if you go through that document, the Commission on Race of 1998, you see that the commissioners systematically and purposely diminished the differences between African Americans on the one hand and Asian Americans on the other, even though by that time we had commanding statistics about how differently black people were affected by racism in the United States than Asian Americans. Asian Americans have been subject to racism in the United States, no question about it. But an accurate account of this would pay a lot more attention to the differences along the way. Black people are uniquely disadvantaged in the United States through a multi-century legacy of enslavement, Jim Crow policies, racialization, miscegenation legislation that puts them in a much lower class position. Many Asian American peoples, particularly of the era since about 1970 when the new migration comes in, many of the Asian Americans entered the United States with very high educational level. Most of the Koreans that come to the United States are college graduates. English fluency is very common. Now, there's a spectrum within the Asian American population, okay, but in 1998, if you're trying to do any kind of statistical analysis of the different communities of descent in the United States, they have very different histories and presumably might invite different policies for equity. As a result of the failure to revise this old assumption, we do not get fresh thinking about how to deal with inequality in the United States.
So you're saying essentially that there needs to be more precision applied to these categories, or maybe these categories need to be changed, like the traditional ethno-racial categories of Hispanic and Asian American and Native American and African American, in order to make sure what? That the truly deserving people are given special treatment as opposed to a bunch of other groups, in this case subgroups of these groups, that may not need the assistance offered by these programs?
I would put it a little bit differently. I mean, I can understand why people put it that way. I would say that in the interest of public policy and national self-knowledge, it would be good that we had a census system that would count people in more accurate categories. For example, if we were to count people by national origin rather than race, then you might come up with, in any congressional district, where the Vietnamese are, where the Chinese are, where the Japanese are, where the African Americans are. And for the purpose of enforcing anti-discrimination remedies in elections, as well as many others, you'd have a set of categories that then you could use or not use depending on the policy goal. For example, with regard to Hispanics, well, does that include Argentinians? Well, they're mostly from Italy and Spain. So there's a strong European base there. What about Portuguese? So that the difficulty with the Hispanic category, if it's not broken down, is that it conflates a lot of very different historical circumstances and different degrees of debasement and discrimination within American history. So a lot of us who've been arguing about the census for the last 15 or 20 years have suggested that we do need different categories. So it's not just a matter of, like, who's deserving. It's a matter of where inequalities have been the most deeply ingrained in American life and where people have a greater capacity to get beyond them. I mean, it's very interesting within the African-American population, for example, that the immigrant groups from Jamaica, from the Caribbean, and from Kenya and Nigeria, these Americans are much better able to overcome the barriers created by white supremacy than the descendants of American slavery and Jim Crow and the whole institutionalized debasement of black people that's such a prominent part of the history of the United States.
So you're saying that studies have shown that immigrants of African descent to the United States, they do better in the face of anti-black racism than African Americans?
No question about it. And then the question becomes, well, who is an African American? I mean, are we going to count the descendants of the new immigrants? Well, maybe we should. But remember Barack Obama himself, whose blackness follows from immigration, not from the history of slavery and Jim Crow like his wife's. Obama himself used to say that it's not clear at all that his daughter should get the benefits of affirmative action. So that's an example of what is a real challenge as to how go about designing those programs. I like to say that the system that we've got is sort of like a world map that's a Mercator projection. So it's great for the purposes of putting up everything up on the wall, but Greenland is really large and Ecuador and Indonesia are really small as a result of the Mercator projection. Well, our whole system of ethno-racial classification meets certain purposes, sort of like the purpose of having a big wall map. But there are other purposes it doesn't reach at all, and that's why I'm saying there's something anachronistic about it.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. David Hollinger joins us. He is an author, an historian, a professor emeritus at UC Berkeley. His books include Cosmopolitanism and Solidarity, Studies in Ethno-Racial, Religious, and Professional Affiliation in the United States, and Post-Ethnic America, Beyond Multiculturalism, among other books. And he contributed an article about cosmopolitanism and solidarity to a new volume. It's called Cosmopolitanisms, and it's published by New York University Press. So if we stick with this issue of people of African descent, and so we have African Americans, but we also have people coming from regions like the Caribbean and from Africa and from many other places, how big of an issue is it for you that, let's say, they're all lumped together for purposes of universities reporting that, you know, we accepted so many blacks or so many blacks matriculated here, and here, therefore, is a sign of our efforts to address diversity on campus? How big of an issue is it that perhaps a significant portion of those blacks are, in fact, immigrants?
Is it? How important is it? Well, I think it is important because it's easy for people to be misled about cause and effect. It's easy for people to be misled in thinking that all blacks are alike, and they're not. On the other hand, any progress is valuable. I mean, if black people have been discriminated against in colleges, then we need more black people in colleges. And so I can understand why people have gone the direction that they have. But we need to also remember that these efforts to deal with the injustices experienced by African Americans are part of a larger system. And we need ways of dealing with one part of the system that also work in other parts of the system. And it's in that context that, you know, the word cosmopolitanism has come more into vogue the last few years. And it might be worth saying something about that. And since you just mentioned this book, I want to observe that the new popularity of the word cosmopolitanism comes about in the context of a long history of two other words that were often used to talk about how to deal with the injustices experienced by African Americans in particular, and also by other non-white groups. Now, those other two terms were pluralism and universalism. And when people talked about pluralism, there was an effort to recognize many different groups in American life and many different groups in the world. And you were pluralistic if you overcame a bias against any of these groups. So you develop a sense of the equality of all groups. So pluralists affirm the diversity of the society and of the world. They tend to want to defend the integrity, they would say, of the different groups. Now, the universalists come along, and they're less interested in group integrity than they are in applying universal rules of justice. So they would want to say that what matters is not so much what your group identity is, but that you're a human being. So you have policies that would try to deal with everybody equally. Now, for a long time, pluralism and universalism were sort of united against bias, against ethnocentrism, against racism, against provincialism. And often the word cosmopolitanism was used as a synonym for those. So cosmopolitans, pluralists, universalists, they're all sort of against racism and so on. But what's happened the last 40 or 50 years is that the deficiencies of both pluralism and universalism have become more apparent. Going back to this earlier point I made about the tension between the two goals, tribal goals, intimacy and belonging. You have to have a set of community where people can actually do stuff together. And on the other hand, global justice, dealing with global warming, dealing with large problems, portions of large scale. So what the cosmopolitans do is they come in and they say, look, pluralism is too oriented to the group. It's too inclined to defend traditional groups. It's too resistant to new alliances. And the universalists are too oblivious to the needs that human beings have for communities with intimacy and belonging. So the universalists come along and say, well, everybody's all alike. We just need programs that will treat everybody equally. So the cosmopolitans then come into this and say, well, now it's a little bit more complicated. I mean, we've got to deal with both of these needs. And it's there that these differences between the national cultures and the constitutional regimes come about. So a cosmopolitan in India might be operating on a different basis than a cosmopolitan in the United States. So, yes, the situation in African Americans is absolutely central to any understanding of these problems in the United States. No question about it. But how we deal with it, bringing us back to Du Bois, puts us in the larger question of the color line, not only black and white, but other color lines. And that puts us in the larger context of the problem of solidarity.
How would you feel, David, if we kept the ethno-racial categories, and I know you don't want to do that, but just hang in there with me. We kept the ethno-racial categories as they were, but we added a consideration that related to economics, to economic situation, to economic marginalization. Then would we be closer in your mind to something that serves the interest of justice when it comes to programs dealing with diversity?
I would say yes, in that it's so hard to make any changes in the situation that we have that piecemeal changes like that can help. Because what we have been doing in many cases is to use an ethno-racial category as a proxy for an economic condition. For example, if you talk about the population that the Census Bureau calls Hispanic, Latino, Hispanic, okay, well, here you have a population that, as a result of American policies, recruits poorly educated people from Latin American countries so that they can perform certain kinds of labor in the United States. So we talk about the disadvantages that the Hispanic population has, and much of it has to do with an economic conditions which is specifically mandated by American immigration and business policies. Whereas the Asian American population, it's very different. I mean, you're recruiting all these engineers and very high-tech people from India and throughout Asia. So the pre-immigration base is economically very different. So I think that to add economic situation to it would help a little bit. But as I said earlier, I think we're much better off junking the concept of race altogether and going with national origin, which we can then correlate with the economic statistics that is also gathered by the Census Bureau.
That's the voice of David Hollinger. He's Preston Hotchkiss Professor Emeritus of History at UC Berkeley, and we are talking about his work on cosmopolitanism. He calls the problem of the 21st century the problem of solidarity. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with David. Please stay with us. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. David Hollinger joins me. He is a professor emeritus of history at UC Berkeley, and he's written books like Cosmopolitanism and Solidarity and After Cloven Tongues of Fire, Protestant Liberalism and Modern American History. And we are talking about an essay he contributed to a new volume. It's called Cosmopolitanisms. It's edited by Bruce Robbins and Paulo Lemos Horta. So, David, you were talking about economics as being an important factor. You had also alluded earlier to the educational background of people coming to the U.S., immigrants, whether it be the person themselves who is at issue or the parents of the person, let's say a student who comes over here to a university and the university is wondering how to deal with them in terms of whether they see the addition of this person as increasing diversity on campus. So how would you weigh economics versus education and educational background as factors, as important factors to take into account?
It's very difficult to separate out education from economic position because very often more highly educated individuals are able to make more money, have higher household income to support themselves and their families. And if you have a strong enough economic base, then you're more likely to be able to educate your own children. So it continues in that way. So I guess I'm reluctant to separate out too much the economy from the educational status. Both are very important. But if you begin with either of the two, you're much more likely to advance the second.
And you are arguing, or are you not arguing, that the power of racism to damage people differs depending on their economic or educational circumstance?
I think that the class position of all historically disadvantaged ethno-racial groups in the United States does affect how they are treated by empowered whites and by the establishment. And this is not something that I just thought up. We've got all these sociologists that have been studying race and class in American society for a very long time. And the cases that are quite striking within the African-American population have to do, indeed, with, say, the Ethiopians, the Nigerians and the Jamaicans, as opposed to people who are the descendant of many generations of Jim Crow in Mississippi, and for that matter, racism in the North. So that's an empirically warranted difference about the capacity of these people to overcome the barriers of white racism. Now, within, say, the Asian American population, there's also a huge difference between the Hmong and some of the other Asian ethnic groups that come in with very weak class position, with poor educational background, with very little commercial experience. And so there's a great difference between them and the average migrant from Hong Kong, Taiwan, or South Korea, where generally come in with commercial skills, high degree of literacy, often English fluency, makes a big difference as to how you can get ahead in the society. So I'm just saying that there's a great variety of behaviors and situations of non-white groups in the United States. And people who identify with cosmopolitan aspirations are usually eager to see policies developed that recognize these differences.
What about the mixing of different races as a result of marriage and reproduction across racial lines? What should we know about that?
I think that's very important because it cuts against this old assumption that a black is a black, a brown is a brown, a yellow is a yellow, and so forth, and requires a little bit more sensitivity in how we classify these people. So our statistics on cross-group marriage and reproduction over the last 30 years have increased greatly, even with black-white marriages, which is the lowest level, but it's still much higher than it used to be. Blacks and whites are now marrying one another about four or five times as often as Jews and non-Jews did in 1940. Doesn't mean that we'll have follow the same trajectory, but it does mean that the direction is the same, even if it doesn't reach the same statistics eventually. So, yes, ethno-racial mixture, very big thing in the United States and needs to be addressed much more frontally, I think, by discussants of this whole cluster of issues.
David Hollinger joins us. He's Professor Emeritus of History at UC Berkeley. And if we get back to this issue of solidarity, I mean, at the beginning of this hour, you defined it as willed affiliation, kind of voluntary affiliation. And yet, in some ways, I feel like what we've been talking about is not so much willed affiliation, but how people should be viewed, how people should be, what categories they should be placed in by people overseeing diversity issues in the U.S. So can you clarify this for me? Like, how does what you're saying address the problem of solidarity?
The census is a system by which individuals are told what matters about them. The census tells people that you are either this, that, or the other, and you choose between these old race categories. So even if you have an opportunity to click one rather than another, these are ascribed categories rather than chosen categories, and the individual filling out the forms is expected to choose the ascribed category. That's why people get so agitated whenever there's some press story about some white person claiming to be black or some black person claiming to be white. But the system that we have is one that tells people what their identity is. Now, identity is, after all, performative, and that's why it's so connected with solidarity. So when I talk about willed affiliation, solidarity as willed affiliation, I'm talking about what many people mean when they invoke the concept of identity. The term identity is very misleading, however, because many people take it to refer to something that's fixed and primordial, when all our social scientists and historians keep telling us that these identities are products of history. Now, the difference between a willed affiliation and something that's not willed is when you don't have any doubts about what your identity is, who you have solidarity with, either because you've never been given any choice in the matter because of, you know, racialization, for example. You've never been given any choice in the matter, or you've never experienced the historical circumstances that call into question what the assumption is about your identity, which is to say your capacity, your obligation for dealing with other people who you can count on, what your solidarity is. But when historical circumstances then challenge that identity, challenge that affiliation, suggest that there are other kinds of people that you might want to affiliate with and that you have interests that are better served by affiliation with them rather than those that you're constantly told you should affiliate with, well, that's what I mean about willed affiliation. The problem of solidarity, it doesn't become a problem until there's at least some agency involved. An identity that is not willed is something that's just taken for granted. Whereas if you have any choice in the matter at all, then it becomes a matter of will. That's when the concept of solidarity becomes operative.
My guest David Hollinger has a new book coming out later this year. It's called Protestants Abroad: How Missionaries Tried to Change the World but Changed America. And this book is about missionary cosmopolitanism, so it relates to, you know, what we've been talking about this hour, which is cosmopolitanisms. What is missionary cosmopolitanism? What is this book about?
This is a book about the American Protestants who go abroad in the early and mid-20th century to places like China and India and Japan and the Arab societies of Western Asia especially. And when they're over there, they often decide that making the rest of the world more like American Protestants isn't such a good idea after all. So they come back to the United States. They and their children come back to the United States, and they begin arguing against American provincialism. They begin arguing against home truths. They begin arguing against a lot of the ideas that are very common in the American Protestant communities that sent them abroad. I call them missionary cosmopolitans because they come back with this much more global vision, with a sense that we really need to be engaging global problems, if not on a universalist basis, on some basis that recognizes the integrity of these different communities. These people go abroad as you might call, let's see, they're claiming to be universalists because they believe that Christianity is the universal answer to everything. And they change their mind when they develop respect for the local communities that they find in China and India and all over the world. So they become cosmopolitans in the very sense that I'm talking about it, in that they retain a vision of a species-wide welfare, that they want everybody to sort of be better off. But they decide that one answer doesn't fit all, and particularly Protestant Christianity doesn't fit all. So they come back and they say, well, you know, it's okay for us Presbyterians here in Dubuque, Iowa, to continue to do our thing, but we shouldn't expect everybody in the world to follow suit. And the whole idea of going abroad to change them was not a good idea. So these folks, the missionary cosmopolitans, they then develop service programs, and they decide that what Shanghai needs is not more Christians, but more medical schools and a variety of service programs like that. So their activities abroad change, and their impact back on the home culture changes as well. So they're, I call them missionary cosmopolitans because it is a variety of cosmopolitanism that enters American life through the Protestant Missionary Project.
And what kind of impact and in what arenas did these returning missionaries and their children have on attitudes and on policy?
They turn up in a remarkable number of arenas of American public life. We've been talking a lot about race and ethnicity in American life in the more recent period. But if you go back to the 1940s and you're looking around for Anglo-Protestants who were really involved in civil rights for black people, these missionary characters were just extravagantly overrepresented. I mean, you go to one setting after another where the leaders of the black civil rights movement, the NAACP and so forth, when they're trying to get white allies, and okay, they got the Communist Party. There's been a lot of discussion of that. But they also had a lot of these missionaries. So if you go through the records of what's going on in the 1940s in civil rights, you find that missionary-connected American Protestants are really big. So that's one. But another, moving now away from some of the domains of American life that we've been talking about here, C.S., moving into some other stuff, these missionary cosmopolitans are very prominent in the State Department, in the Foreign Service, in American intelligence agencies. It also applies, you know, outside of government in public discussion about what American foreign policy should be. Now, the main theme that you find in these domains, the State Department, the Foreign Service, the OSS, the CIA, and public discussion about foreign policy, the main theme that you find there is in some ways parallel to this pro-civil rights sort of pre-multiculturalist stuff that you get when they're talking about domestic policy. What you get when missionary cosmopolitanism applies itself to foreign affairs is a conviction that the interest of the United States should be closely allied with the self-defined interests of the non-white decolonizing peoples of the rest of the world. So these characters, and they're in the State Department, they're involved in constant fights with other State Department officers who whose tradition has been to deal with the European colonial powers. So I have one guy who shows up in 1941, former missionary to Thailand, and he's brought in to meet with all these generals and the top State Department brass. And the first thing he says is, what you guys need to understand is that the British Empire is done in Asia. And if there's going to be any future over there, the United States has to take over the military role of the British Empire. Now, he wasn't advocating this. He was just saying, look, the world is changing, and the whole era of European colonialism and imperialism is about to be over. Well, they didn't want to hear this in 1941. They didn't want to hear it. But that's an interesting example, C.S., because it's a case of where missionary-connected people were very early in developing a line that then becomes quite popular later on when people are saying, hey, the United States was too closely connected to the old colonial powers, and we should have been doing stuff that was a little bit more patient with the nationalist movements of the decolonizing world. So foreign affairs is another of the big areas. I'll just mention briefly, there are really quite a lot of these, that others is the churches themselves. I mean, these missionaries really change American churches. They turn them in ecumenical directions, anti-sectarian directions, greater political involvement. The social gospel, which a lot of people associate with the early 20th century, social gospel gets a huge push in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s from missionaries.
How ironic is it that, as you write, an enterprise driven by ethnocentrism and cultural imperialism, we're talking about the missionary enterprise, and often linked closely with military, diplomatic, and economic imperialism, generated the reaction you're describing in the hearts and minds and activities in U.S. of missionaries and their children and their affiliates?
This is a great argument for diversity, because it's an example of how people who had not been exposed to very much outside a Western Christian, particularly Protestant culture, when they are really deeply immersed in this foreign stuff, they overcome a lot of biases that were generated by their own parochialism. And the missionary case is especially worth talking about in the degree of immersion in things foreign, because I found that a lot of the Americans who live abroad in business families, military families, diplomatic families, experience some of this deprovincialization, but not nearly as much, because they don't stay as long in the same location. They don't have as much incentive to learn the local languages and cultures. Or as what happens with the missionary types is that they go for a long time, and they're embedded in these communities. And many of the children of missionaries are bilingual at birth, and many of them say that they learned their Chinese or their Japanese before they learned English. So when these folks come back to the United States, they have a whole wealth of experience that's quite unusual in the U.S. Now, this is partly a chronologically bounded situation, because after World War II, when the United States is much more involved all over the world, there are other sources for understanding the non-European world, and the significance of the missionary class diminishes considerably. Also, missions largely dry up among the more well-educated ecumenical liberal denominations. But what had happened in World War II is that suddenly the United States has a desperate need for people who know these foreign languages and know something about these societies. So there are a lot of cases where people would show up in Washington, missionary types, and they would discover that they were the only ones around that knew anything. Like when Edwin Reischauer, the great scholar of Japanese studies at Harvard for many years after the war, and later ambassador to Japan, actually, when Edwin Reischauer showed up in 1942, actually, right after Pearl Harbor, shows up in Washington to take over his group about Japanese language training, everybody in the room was, like him, a missionary's son or a former missionary. So the missionaries had almost a monopoly on deep knowledge of many aspects of the world at the start of World War II. And as a result of that, a lot of these people get catapulted into positions of enormous influence, and therefore missionary cosmopolitanism becomes a prominent feature of American life, especially in the 1940s and 1950s. Yes, it is ironic. It is ironic that something generated out of ethnocentrism and cultural imperialism has the opposite effect. But one of the things that I keep stressing in this book is that it's a validation of a vindication of contact theory, which the sociologists tell us is the idea that if you spend a lot of time abroad where you really get to know different kinds of people, it does affect your attitudes. So the contact theorists among sociologists, Gordon Allport was an example of that. They tell us that one of the reasons that gays and lesbians are more respected in the United States today is because a lot of people that didn't realize there were any around suddenly found out that their nephew was gay. And that so the proximity of what had been a stigmatized group really made a difference. So contact theory, as it applies to race, to sexual orientation, a lot of things, makes a big difference. So contact theory is relevant to my missionary story because you have a population that really didn't know very much about South Asian society. Then you get a lot of Presbyterians and Congregationalists. They go over there and they spend a couple generations there, and then they come back and say, hey, you know, we shouldn't be worried so much about Hinduism. I mean, it's different than what we got, but it ain't so bad. So you have missionaries writing these treatises defending the other religions of the world against Christian imperialism.
David Hollinger talking about his forthcoming book, Protestants Abroad, How Missionaries Tried to Change the World but Changed America. It will be published by Princeton University Press. David is Preston Hotchkiss Professor Emeritus at UC Berkeley. We have also been talking about his article in the new volume, Cosmopolitanisms, edited by Bruce Robbins and Paulo Lemos Horta. David, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.